She was tall for a woman, but she still had to look up at him. She might never have seen him before.
"You are a troublesome man, Matt Cawthon. Linny would say I was repeating myself, but you—"
Expelling her breath, Elaine reached up to pull his hat off and slipped the cord over his head. She actually tucked the fox head into his shirt and patted it before handing him his hat.
"I won't wear that while Nynaeve still doesn't have one, or Avienda. And I think they feel the same. You wear it. After all, you can hardly keep your promise if Mogerion kills you. Not that I think she's still here. I think she believes she killed Nynaeve, and I would not be surprised if that was all she came for. You must be careful, though. Nynaeve says there's a storm coming, and she doesn't mean this wind. I..."
That faint blush returned to her cheeks.
"I am sorry I laughed at you."
She cleared her throat, looking away.
"Sometimes I forget my duty to my subjects. You are a worthy subject, Matrim Cawthon. I will see that Nynaeve understands the right of you and Tylin. Perhaps we can help."
"No," he spluttered. "I mean, yes. I mean, that is... Oh, kiss a flaming goat if I know what I mean. I almost wish you didn't know the truth."
Nynaeve and Elaine sitting down to discuss him with Tylin over tea. Could he ever live that down? Could he ever again look any of them in the eye afterward? But if they did not... He was between the wolf and the bear with nowhere to run.
"Oh, sheep swallop! Sheep swallop and bloody buttered onions!"
He nearly wished she would call him down for his language the way Nynaeve would, just to change the subject. Her lips moved silently, and for an instant he had the strange impression that she was repeating what he had just said. Of course not. He was seeing things, that was all. Aloud, she said,
"I understand,"
sounding just as if she did.
"Come along now, Matt. We can't waste time standing in one spot."
Gaping, he watched her lift skirts and cloak to make her way along the landing.
She understood? She understood, and not one acid little comment, not one cutting remark? And he was her subject, her worthy subject?
Fingering the medallion, he followed. He had been sure the fight would be to ever get it back. If he lived as long as two Aes Sedai, he still would never understand women, and noble women were purely the worst. When he reached the steps Elaine had gone down, the boat's two brass earring doorsmen were already using their long sweeps to push the vessel away. Elaine was herding Rihanna and the last of the wise women into the cabin, and Lan stood up in the bows with Nynaeve. A shout from Beslan called him on to the next boat, which held all of the men except the warder.
"Nynaeve said there wasn't any room for any of us,"
Nalisian said as the boat rocked its way out into the Elder.
"She said we'd crowd them."
Beslan laughed, looking around their own boat. Vannon sat beside the cabin door with his eyes closed, trying to pretend he was somewhere else. Harnan and Tad Candle, and Andoran, despite being as dark as either of the boatmen, had climbed atop the cabin. The rest of the Red Arms hunkered about the deck, trying to keep out of the way of the rowers. Nobody went into the cabin, all apparently waiting to see whether Matt and Elysian and Beslan wanted it. Matt put himself beside the tall bow post, peering after the other boat, crawling on its sweeps just ahead. The wind whipped the dark, choppy waters, and his scarf as well, and he had to hold on to his hat. What was Nynaeve up to? The other nine women on the second boat were all in the cabin, leaving the deck to her and Lan. They stood up in the bows, Lan with his arms folded, Nynaeve gesturing as though explaining. Except that Nynaeve seldom explained anything. Better say never than seldom. Whatever she was doing, it did not last long. There were whitecaps out in the bay, where seafolk rakers and skimmers and soarers heaved at their anchors. The river was not so bad, but the boat still wallowed more than Matt remembered from any previous trip. Before long, Nynaeve was draped over the railing, losing her breakfast while Lan held her. That reminded Matt of his own belly. Tucking his hat under his arm so it could not blow away, he pulled out the wedge of cheese. "Beslan, is this storm likely to break before we come back from the Rahad?" He took a bite of the sharp-tasting cheese. They had 50 different sorts in Ebudar, all good. Nynaeve was still hanging over the side. How much had the woman eaten this morning?
I don't know where we'll shelter if we're caught.
He could not think of a single inn he had seen in the Rahad that he would take the women into.
No storm, Beslan said, seating himself on the railing. These are the winter trade winds. The trades come twice a year, in late winter and late summer. But they have to blow much harder before it comes to storm.
He directed a sour look out toward the bay.
Every year those winds brought ships from Tarabun and Aradaman. I wonder whether they ever will again. The wheel weaves,
Matt began, and choked on a crumb of cheese. Blood and ashes, he was starting to sound like some gray hair resting his aching joints in front of the fireplace. Worrying about taking the women into a rough inn? A year ago, half a year, he would have taken them and laughed when their eyes popped, laughed at every prim sniff.
Well, maybe we'll find you some fun in the Rahad anyway. At the least, somebody will try to cut a purse or pull Elaine's necklace off.
Maybe that was what he needed to clean the taste of sobriety from his tongue.
Sobriety? Light. What a word to apply to Matt Cawthon.
Tannin must be scaring him more than he thought if he was shriveling up this way.
Maybe he needed some of Beslan's sort of fun.
That was crazy. He had never seen the fight he would not rather walk around. But maybe...
Beslan shook his head. If anyone can find it, you can, but we'll be with 7 wise women, Matt. 7. With just 1 at your side, you could slap a man, even in the Rahad, and he would swallow his tongue and walk away. And the women? What's the fun of kissing a woman without the risk she'll decide to stick a knife in you?
Burn my soul, Nalesian muttered into his beard. It sounds as though I've dragged myself from bed for a dull morning.
Beslan nodded in commiseration.
If we're lucky, though, the Civil Guard does send patrols to the Rahad occasionally, and if they're after smugglers, they dress like anyone else. They seem to think nobody will notice a dozen or so men together carrying swords, whatever they wear, and they're always surprised when the smugglers ambush them, which is what nearly always happens. If Matt's Tavirinluck works for us, we might be taken for the Civil Guard, and some smugglers might attack us before they see the red belts.
Elysian brightened and began rubbing his hands together. Matt glared at them. Maybe Beslan's sort of fun was not what he needed. For one thing, he had more than enough of women with knives. Nynaeve still hung over the side of the boat ahead. That would teach her to gorge herself. Wolfing down the last of the cheese, he began on the bread and tried to ignore the dice in his head. An easy trip with no trouble did not sound bad at all. A quick trip with a quick departure from Ebu Dar. The Rahad was everything he remembered, and everything Beslan feared. The wind made climbing the cracked gray stone steps at the boat landing into a perilous feat, and after that it grew worse. Canals ran everywhere, just as across the river, but here the bridges were plain, the grimy stone parapets broken and crumbling. Half the canals were so silted that boys waded waist-deep in them, and hardly a barge was to be seen. Tall buildings stood crowded together, blocky structures with scabrous once-white plaster gone in huge patches to reveal rotting red brick, bordering narrow streets with broken paving stones. In those streets where even the fragments had not been ripped up. Morning did not really reach into the shadows of the buildings. Dingy laundry hung drying from every third window, except where a structure stood empty. Some did, and those windows gaped like eye sockets in a skull. A sour, sweet smell of decay permeated the air, last month's chamber pots and ancient refuse smoldering wherever it had been flung, and for every fly on the other side of the Eldar, 100 buzzed here in clouds of green and blue. He spotted the peeling blue door of the Golden Crown of Heaven, and shuddered at the thought of taking the women in there if the storm broke, despite what Beslan said. Then he shuddered again for having shuddered. Something was happening to him, and he did not like it. Nynaeve and Elaine insisted on taking the lead, with Rihanna between them and the wise women close behind. Lan stayed at Nynaeve's shoulder like a wolfhound, hand on sword hilt, eyes constantly searching, radiating menace. In truth, he was probably enough protection for 2 dozen pretty 16-year-olds carrying sacks of gold, even here. But Matt insisted that Vannin and the rest keep their eyes open. In fact, the former horse thief and poacher kept so close to Elaine that anyone could have been forgiven for thinking he was her warder, if a rather fat and rumpled one. Veslin rolled his eyes expressively at Matt's instructions, and Elysian irritably stroked his beard and muttered that he could still be in bed. Men strutted arrogantly along the streets, with often ragged vests and no shirts, wearing great brass hoops in their ears and brass finger rings set with colored glass. One knife, or sometimes two, stuck behind their belts. Hands hovering near those knives, they stared as though daring someone to give the wrong twist to a look. Others skulked from corner to corner, doorway to doorway, with hooded eyes, imitating the slat-ribbed dogs that sometimes snarled from a dark alleyway, barely wide enough for a man to squeeze into. Those men hunched over their knives, and there was no way to tell which would run and which stab. By and large, the women made any of the men appear humble, parading in worn dresses and twice as much brass jewelry as the men. They carried knives too, of course, and their bold, dark eyes sent 10 sorts of challenge in every glance. In short, the Rahat was the sort of place where anyone wearing silk could hardly hope to walk 10 steps without being cracked over the head, after which they had best hope to wake stripped to the skin and tossed onto a pile of rubbish in an alley, since the alternative was not to wake at all. But children darted from every second door with chipped pottery cups of water sent by their mothers in case the wise women wished a drink. Men with scarred faces and murder etched into their eyes stared open-mouthed at 7 wise women together, then bobbed jerky bows and inquired politely if they could be of assistance. Was there anything that required carrying? Women, sometimes with as many scars and always eyes to make Tylan flinch, curtsied awkwardly and breathlessly asked whether they might supply directions. Had anyone made a bother of themselves to bring so many wise women? If so, the strong implication was, Tamarla and the rest had no need of troubling themselves if they would just supply the name. Oh, they glared at the soldiers as hotly as ever, though even the hardest flinched away from Lan after a single look, and oddly enough from Vannon. A few of the men growled at Veslin and Elysian whenever they gazed too long at a woman's deep neckline. Some growled at Matt, though he could not understand why. Unlike those two, he was never in danger of his eyeballs falling down the front of a woman's dress. He knew how to look discreetly. Nynaeve and Elaine were ignored for all their finery, and so was Rihanna in her red wool dress. They did not have the red belt, but they did have the protection of those belts. Matt realized that Veslin had been right. He could empty his purse on the ground, and no one would pick up a copper, at least so long as the wise women remained. He could pinch the bottom of every woman in sight, and even if she had apoplexy, she would walk away. "What a pleasant walk," Elysian said dryly, "with such interesting sights and smells. Did I tell you I didn't get much sleep last night, Matt?" "Do you want to die in bed?" Matt grumbled. They might as well all have stayed in bed. They were bloody useless here, that was for sure. The tyrant snorted indignantly. Veslin laughed, but he probably thought Matt meant something else. Across the Rahad they marched, until Rihanna finally stopped in front of a building exactly like every other, all flaking plaster and crumbling brick. The same Matt had followed another woman to yesterday. No laundry hung from these windows. Only rats lived in there. "In here," she said. Elaine's eyes climbed slowly to the flat roof. "Six," she murmured in tones of great satisfaction. "Six," Nynaeve sighed, and Elaine patted her arm as though sympathizing with her. "I wasn't really sure," she said. So Nynaeve smiled and patted her. Matt did not understand a word of it. So the building had 6 floors. Women behaved very strangely sometimes. Well, most of the time. Inside, a long hallway carpeted with dust ran dimly to the back, the far end lost in shadows. Few of the doorways held doors, and those were rough planks. One opening, almost a third of the way down the hall, led to a narrow flight of steep stone-faced steps climbing upward. That was the way he had gone the day before, following footprints in the dust, but he thought some of those other openings must be crossing corridors. He had not taken time to look around then, but the building was too deep and too wide for this floor to be served by only the one they saw. It was too big for only one way in. "Really, Matt," Nynaeve said, when he told off Harnan and half the Red Arms to find any way back in and guard it. Van kept so close to his side he might have been glued there.
Don't you see by now there's no need?
Her tone was so mild that Elaine must have passed on the truth about Tylan, but if anything, that only soured his mood further. He did not want anyone to know.
Bloody useless.
But those dice were still rattling around in his head. Maybe Mogedion likes back doors, he said dryly. Something chittered in the dark end of the hall, and one of the men with Harnin cursed loudly about rats.
You told him,
Nynaeve breathed furiously at Lan, one hand snapping shut on her braid. Elaine made an exasperated sound.
This is no time to stop for an argument, Nynaeve. The bowl is upstairs. The bowl of the winds.
A small ball of light suddenly appeared, floating in front of her, and without waiting to see whether or not Nynaeve was coming, she gathered her skirts and darted up the stairs. Vannin dashed after her with a startling turn of speed for his bulk, followed by Rihanna, and most of the wise women. Round-faced Tsumeko and Iaina, tall and dark and pretty despite the lines at the corners of her eyes, hesitated, then remained with Nynaeve. Matt would have gone, too, if Nynaeve and Lan had not been in his way.
"Would you let me by, Nynaeve?" he asked.
He deserved to be there, at least, when this fabulous bloody bull was uncovered.
"Nynaeve?"
She was so focused on Lan she seemed to have forgotten anyone else. Matt exchanged glances with Veslin, who grinned and squatted easily, with Korovin and the remaining Red Arms. Nalesian leaned against the wall and yawned ostentatiously. Which was a mistake with all that dust about. The yawn turned into a coughing fit that darkened his face and doubled him over. Even that did not distract Nynaeve. Carefully, she took her hand away from her braid.
"I am not angry, Lan," she said.
"Yes, you are," he replied calmly, but he had to be told.
"Nynaeve," Matt said. "Lan?"
Neither one of them so much as flickered an eye his way.
"I would have told him when I was ready, Landman Dragoran!"
Her mouth clamped shut, but her lips writhed as though she were talking to herself.
"I will not be angry with you,"
she went on in a much milder tone, and that sounded addressed to herself as well. Very deliberately she tossed her braid back over her shoulder, jerked that blue-plumed hat straight, and clasped her hands at her waist.
"If you say so," Lan said mildly.
Nynaeve quivered.
"Don't you take that tone with me," she shouted. "I tell you I'm not angry. Do you hear me?"
"Blood and ashes, Nynaeve," Matt growled. "He doesn't think you're angry. I don't think you're angry."
A good thing women had taught him to lie with a straight face.
"Now can we go upstairs and fetch this bloody bull of the winds?"
"A marvelous idea," said a woman's voice from the door to the street. "Shall we go up together and surprise Elaine?"
Matt had never seen the two women who walked into the hall before, but their faces were Aes Sedai faces. The speaker's was long and cold as her voice, her companion's, framed by scores of thin dark braids, worked with colored beads. Nearly 2 dozen men crowded in behind them, bulky fellows with heavy shoulders, clubs and knives in hand. Matt shifted his grip on the Ashandarai. He knew trouble when he saw it, and the fox head on his chest was cool, almost cold against his skin. Somebody was holding the one power. The two wise women nearly fell over, dropping curtsies as soon as they saw those ageless faces, but Nynaeve certainly knew trouble, too. Her mouth worked soundlessly as the pair came down the hallway, her face all consternation and self-recrimination. Behind him, Matt heard a sword leaving its scabbard, but he was not about to look back to see whose. Lan just stood there, which meant, of course, that he looked like a leopard ready to pounce.
"They're Black Aja,"
Nynaeve said at last. Her voice started faint and gained strength as she went on.
"Valian Boda and Ispan Shafar. They committed murder in the tower, and worse since. They're dark friends, and—"
Her voice faltered for an instant.
"They have shielded me."
The newcomers continued to advance serenely.
"Have you ever heard such nonsense, Ispan?"
the long-faced Aes Sedai asked her companion, who stopped grimacing at the dust long enough to smirk at Nynaeve.
"Ispan and I come from the White Tower, while Nynaeve and her friends are rebels against the Amaran Seat. They'll be punished severely for that, and so will anyone who helps them."
With a shock, Matt realized the woman did not know. She thought that he and Lan and the others were just hired strong arms. Phelan directed a smile at Nynaeve. It made a blizzard warm by comparison.
"There's someone who will be overjoyed to see you when we take you back, Nynaeve. She thinks you are dead. Better the rest of you go now. You don't want to meddle in Aes Sedai affairs. My men will see you to the river."
Without taking her eyes from Nynaeve, Phelan motioned for the men behind her to come forward. Lan moved. He did not draw his sword, and against Aes Sedai, he should have had no chance if he had. No chance in any case. But one moment he was standing still, and the next he had thrown himself at the pair. Just before he struck, he grunted as though hit hard, but he crashed into them, carrying both black sisters to the dusty floor. That opened the sluice gates wide. Lan pushed himself to hands and knees, shaking his head groggily, and one of the bulky fellows raised an iron-strapped club to smash his skull. Matt stabbed the fellow in the belly with his spear, as Beslan and Nalesian and the five red arms rushed to meet the Dark Friend's shouting charge. Lan staggered to his feet, sword sweeping out to open a Dark Friend from crotch to neck. There was not much room to work sword or Ashandara in the corridor, but the tight quarters were what allowed them to face odds of 2-1 or worse without being overcome in the first moment. Grunting men struggled with them face to face, elbowing each other for room to stab or swing a club at them. Small spaces remained clear around the Black Sisters and around Nynaeve. They saw to that themselves. A wiry Andoran red arm almost bumped into Phelan, but at the last instant, he jerked into the air and flew across the hallway, knocking down two of the heavy-shouldered Dark Friends in his flight before smacking into the wall and sliding down, the back of his head leaving a bloody smear on the cracked, dusty plaster. A bald-headed Dark Friend squeezed through the line of defenders and rushed at Nynaeve with outstretched knife. He yelled as his feet were suddenly jerked back from him, a yell that cut off when his face hit the floor so hard that his head bounced. Obviously Nynaeve was no longer shielded, and if the chilly silver fox head sliding around Matt's chest as he fought was not enough indication that she and the Black Sisters were in some sort of struggle, the way they glared at her and she at them, ignoring the battle around them, shouted the fact. The two wise women looked on in horror. They had their curved knives in their fists, but they huddled against the wall, staring from Nynaeve to the other two with eyes wide and mouths hanging open. "Fight!" Nynaeve snapped at them. She turned her head just a fraction, so she could see them as well as Phelan and Ispan. "I cannot do it alone. They're linked. If you don't fight them, they will kill you. You know about them now." The wise woman gaped at her, as though she had suggested spitting in the queen's face. In the midst of shouts and grunts, Ispan laughed melodiously. In the midst of shouts and grunts, a shrill scream echoed down the stairs. Nynaeve's head swung that way. Suddenly she staggered, and her head swung back like a wounded badger's, with a scowl that should have made Phelan and Ispan leave right then if they had any sense. Nynaeve spared an agonized glance for Matt, though. "There was channeling upstairs," she said through her teeth. "There's trouble." Matt hesitated. More likely Elaine had seen a rat. More likely... He managed to knock aside a dagger thrust at his ribs, but there was no room to stab back with the Ashandarai or use the haft like a quarterstaff. Beslan stabbed past him and took his attacker through the heart.
"Please, Matt," Nynaeve said tightly.
She never begged. She would cut her own throat first.
"Please!"
With a curse, Matt pulled himself out of the fight and dashed up the steep, narrow stairs, taking all six flights in the dark stairwell at a dead run. There was not a single window to give light. If it was just a rat, he was going to shake Elaine till her teeth. He burst out onto the top floor, not much brighter than the stairwell with only one window at the street end, burst into a scene from nightmare. Women lay sprawled everywhere. Elaine was one, half on her back against the wall, eyes closed. Vannin crouched on his knees, blood streaming from nose and ears, feebly trying to pull himself up against the wall. The last woman on her feet, Janira, fled toward Matt as soon as she saw him. He had thought of her as a hawk, with her hooked beak of a nose and sharp cheekbones, but her face was pure terror now, those dark eyes wide and stark.
"Help me!"
she screamed at him, and a man caught her from behind. He was an ordinary-looking fellow, maybe a little older than Matt, of the same height and slender in a plain gray coat. Smiling, he took Janira's head between his hands and twisted sharply. The sound of her neck breaking was like a dry branch snapping. He let her drop in a boneless heap and gazed down at her. For a moment, his smile looked rapturous. By the light of a pair of lanterns, a small knot of men just beyond Vannon were prying open a door to the squeal of rusted hinges. But Matt hardly noticed. His eyes went from Janira's crumpled corpse to Elaine. He had promised to keep her safe for Rand. He had promised. With a cry, he launched himself at the killer, Ashandare extended. Matt had seen Murdral move, but this fellow was quicker, hard as that was to believe. He just seemed to flow from in front of the spear, and seizing the haft, he pivoted, flinging Matt past him 5 paces down the hall. Breath left when he hit the floor in a small cloud of dust. So did the Ashandare. Struggling for air, he pushed himself up, fox head dangling from his open shirt. Dragging a knife from under his coat, he flung himself at the man again, just as Nalesian appeared at the head of the stairs, sword in hand. Now they had him. However quick he... The man made a Murdral seem stiff. He slid around Nalesian's thrust as though there was not a bone in his body, right hand shooting out to seize Nalesian's throat. His hand came away with a liquid, ripping sound. Blood fountained past Nalesian's beard. His sword dropped, ringing on the dusty stone floor, and he clutched both hands to his ruined neck, red running through his fingers as he fell. Matt crashed into the killer's back, and they all three hit the floor together. He had no compunctions about stabbing a man in the back when it was necessary, especially a man who could tear somebody's throat out. He should have let Nalesian stay in bed. The thought came sadly as he drove the blade home hard, then a second time, a third. The man twisted in his grip. It should not have been possible, but somehow the fellow rolled over beneath him, pulling the knife hilt out of his hand. Nalesian's staring eyes and bloody throat were a reminder right before his eyes. Desperately he grabbed the man's wrists, one hand slipping a little in the blood that ran down the fellow's hand. The man smiled at him. With a knife sticking out of his side, he smiled.
"He wants you dead as much as he wants her," he said softly.
And as if Matt was not holding him at all, his hands moved toward Matt's head, driving Matt's arms back. Matt pushed frantically, threw all of his weight against the fellow's arms to no avail. Light, he might as well have been a child fighting a grown man. The fellow was making a game of it, taking his bloody time. Hands touched his head. Where was his flaming luck? He gave a heave with what seemed his last strength, and the medallion fell against the man's cheek. The man screamed. Smoke rose around the edges of the fox head, and a sizzle like bacon frying. Convulsively, he hurled Matt away with hands and feet both. This time Matt flew 10 paces and slid. When he scrambled to his feet, half dazed, the man was already up, hands trembling at his face. A raw red brand marked where the fox head had fallen. Gingerly, Matt fingered the medallion. It was cool. Not the cool of someone channeling nearby. Maybe they were still at it below, but that was too far off. Just the cool of silver. He had no notion what this fellow was, except that he certainly was not human. But between that burn and 3 stab wounds, with the knife hilt still jutting out beneath his arm, he had to be slowed enough for Matt to get past him to the stairs. Avenging Elaine was all very well, and Nalesian too, but it was not going to happen today, apparently, and there was no call to supply a reason for avenging Matt Cawthon. Jerking the knife out of his side, the man hurled it at him. Matt snagged it out of the air without thinking. Tom had taught him to juggle, and Tom said he had the quickest hands he had ever seen. Flipping the knife around so he held it properly, point slanted up, he noticed the gleaming blade, and his heart sank. No blood. There should have at least been a smear of red, but the steel shone bright and clean. Maybe even 3 stab wounds was not going to slow this... whatever he was. He risked a glance over his shoulder. The other men were streaming out of that door they had pried open, the door those footprints had led him to yesterday, but their arms seemed full of rubbish, small half-rotted chests, a cask with cloth-wrapped objects bulging through missing staves, even a broken chair and a cracked mirror. They must have had orders to take everything. Paying no attention whatever to Matt, they hurried toward the far end of the hall and vanished around a corner. There had to be another set of stairs back there. Maybe he could follow them at a distance. Maybe... Just before the doorway they had come out of, Vannon made another effort to stand and fell back. Matt bit back a curse. Lugging Vannon was going to slow him, but if his luck was in... It had not saved Elaine, but maybe... From the corner of his eye, he saw her move, lifting a hand to her head. The man in the gray coat saw it, too. With a smile, he turned toward her. Sighing, Matt tucked the useless knife into its scabbard.
"You can't have her!"
he said loudly.
Promises.
One jerk broke the leather cord around his neck. The silver fox head dangled a foot below his fist. It made a low hum as he whirled it in a double loop.
You can't bloody have her!
He started forward, keeping the medallion spinning. The first step was the hardest, but he had a promise to keep. The fellow's smile faded. Watching the flashing fox head warily, he backed away on his toes. The same light that glittered on the whirling silver, from the single window, made a halo around him. If Matt could drive him that far, maybe he could see whether a six-story drop would do what a knife could not. Brand livid on his face, the fellow backed away, sometimes half-reaching as if to try grabbing past the medallion. And suddenly, he darted to one side, into one of the rooms. This one had a door that he pulled shut behind him. Matt heard the bar drop. Maybe he should have left it there, but without thinking, he raised a foot and slammed the heel of his boot against the center of the door. Dust leaped off the rough wood. A second kick, and rotten bar catches gave way, along with a rusted hinge. The door fell in, hanging at a slanted angle. The room was not entirely dark. A little light reached it from the window at the end of the hall, just one door away, and a broken triangle of mirror leaning against the far wall spread a faint illumination. That mirror let him see everything without going in. Aside from that and a piece of a chair, there was nothing else to see. The only openings were the doorway and a rat hole beside the mirror, but the man in the gray coat was gone.
Matt,
Elaine called faintly. He hurried away from the room as much as toward her. There was shouting somewhere below, but Nynaeve and the rest would have to take care of themselves for the moment. Elaine was sitting up, working her jaw and wincing, when he knelt beside her. Dust covered her dress, her hat hung askew, some of the plumes broken, and her red-gold hair looked as if she had been dragged by it.
"He hit me so hard,"
she said painfully.
"I don't think anything is broken, but..."
Her eyes latched onto his, and if he had ever thought she looked at him as if he were a stranger, he saw it for true now.
"I saw what you did, Matt. With him. We might as well have been chickens in a box with a weasel. Channeling wouldn't touch him. The flows melted the way they do with your..."
Glancing at the medallion still hanging from his fist, she drew a breath that did interesting things to that oval cutout.
"Thank you, Matt. I apologize for everything I ever did or thought."
She sounded as though she really meant it.
"I keep building up toe toward you,"
she smiled ruefully.
"But I am not going to let you beat me. You are going to have to let me save you at least once to balance matters."
"I'll see what I can arrange," he said dryly, stuffing the medallion into a coat pocket.
"Toe? Beat her?"
"Light." The woman was definitely spending too much time with Avienda. Once he helped her to her feet, she looked at the hallway, at Vannin with his blood-smeared face, and the women lying where they had fallen, and she grimaced.
"Oh, light," she breathed. "Oh, blood and bloody flaming ashes."
Despite the situation, he gave a start. It was not just that he had never expected to hear those words out of her mouth. They seemed peculiar, as if she knew the sounds but not the meanings. Somehow, they made her sound younger than she looked. Shaking off his arm, she discarded her hat, just tossing it aside, and hurried to kneel beside the nearest wise woman, Rihanna, and take her head in both hands. The woman lay limp, face down, and arms stretched out as though she had been tripped up running. Toward the room everyone had been after, toward her attacker. Not away.
"This one is beyond me,"
Elaine muttered.
"Where is Nynaeve? Why didn't she come up with you, Matt? Nynaeve!"
she shouted toward the stairs.
"No need to shriek like a cat,"
Nynaeve growled, appearing in the stairwell. She was looking back over her shoulder down the stairs, though.
"You hold her tight, you hear me?"
she shrieked like a cat. She carried her hat and shook it at whoever she was shouting at.
"You let her get away, too, and I'll box your ears till you hear bells next year!"
She turned then, and her eyes nearly bulged out of her head.
"The light shine on us,"
she breathed, hurrying to bend over Janira. One touch, and she straightened, wincing painfully. He could have told her the woman was dead. Nynaeve seemed to take death personally. Giving herself a shake, she went on to the next. To Marla, and this time it appeared there was something she could heal. It also appeared Tamarla's injuries were not simple because she knelt over her, frowning.
"What happened here, Matt?"
she demanded without looking around at him. Her tone made him sigh. He might have known she would decide it was his fault.
"Well, Matt, what happened? Will you speak up, man, or do I have to—"
He never learned what threat she intended to offer. Lan had followed Nynaeve out of the stairwell, of course, with Sumeiko right at his heels. The stout wise woman took one look at the hall and immediately lifted her skirts and ran to Rihanna. She did give Elaine one worried glance before lowering herself to her knees and beginning to move her hands over Rihanna in an odd way. That was what pulled Nynaeve up short.
"What are you doing?"
she said sharply. Not halting what she was doing to Tamarla, she spared the round-faced woman only short glances, but they were as piercing as her voice.
"Where did you learn that?"
Sumeiko gave a start, but her hands did not stop.
"Forgive me, Aes Sedai,"
she said in a breathless, disjointed rush.
"I know I'm not supposed to. She'll die if I don't. I know I wasn't supposed to keep trying to. I just wanted to learn, Aes Sedai. Please."
"No, no, go on,"
Nynaeve said absently. Most of her attention was fixed on the woman under her hands, but not all.
"You seem to know a few things even I... That is to say, you have a very interesting way with the flows. I suspect you'll find that a great many sisters want to learn from you."
Half under her breath, she added, "Maybe now they'll leave me alone." Sumeiko could not have heard that last, but what she did hear dropped her chin to her considerable chest. Her hands barely paused, though.
"Elaine,"
Nynaeve went on,
"would you look for the bull, please? I suspect that door is the one."
She nodded to the correct door, standing open like half a dozen others. That made Matt blink until he saw two tiny cloth-wrapped bundles lying in front of it where the looters must have dropped them.
"Yes,"
Elaine muttered.
"Yes, I can do that much, at least."
Half raising a hand toward Vannon, still on his knees, she let it fall with a sigh and strode through the doorway, which almost immediately emitted a cloud of dust and the sound of coughing. The more-than-plump wise woman had not been the only one following Nynaeve and Lan. Eina stalked out of the stairwell, forcing the Terrabonner dark friend in front of her by means of an arm twisted up into her back and a fist clutching the back of her neck. Eina's jaw was set, her mouth tight. Her face was half-frightened certainty that she would be skinned alive for manhandling an Aes Sedai, and half-determination to hold on no matter what. Nynaeve had that effect on people sometimes. The Black Sister was wide-eyed with terror, sagging so she surely would have fallen except for Eina's grip. She must have been shielded, certainly, and with equal surety, she probably would have chosen being skinned to whatever was going to happen to her. Tears began leaking from her eyes, and her mouth sagged in silent sobs. Behind them came Beslan, who gave a sad sigh at the sight of Nalesian, and a sadder for the women, and then Harnan, and three of the Red Arms, Fergan, Gordoran, and Metwin. Three who had been at the front of the building. Harnan and two of the others had bloody gashes in their coats, but Nynaeve must have healed them below. They did not move as if they still had injuries. They looked very subdued, though. "What happened at the back?" Matt asked quietly.
"Burn me if I know," Harnan replied. "We walked right into a knot of shoulder-thumpers with knives in the dark. There was one... moved like a snake."
He shrugged, touching the blood-stained hole in his coat absentmindedly.
"One of them got a knife into me, and the next I remember is opening my eyes with Nynaeve Sedai bending over me, and Mendare and the others dead as yesterday's mutton."
Matt nodded. "One who moved like a snake. And got out of rooms like one, too." He looked around the hallway. Rihanna and Tamarla were on their feet, straightening their dresses, of course, and Vannon peering into the room where Elaine was apparently trying out some more curses, seemingly with no more success than earlier. It was hard to tell because of the coughing. Nynaeve stood, helping up Sibella, a scrawny yellow-haired woman, and Sumeiko was still working on Fumella, with her pale honey hair and big brown eyes. But he was never going to admire Melora's bosom again. Rihanna knelt to straighten her limbs and close her eyes, while Tamarla performed the same service for Janira. Two wise women dead, and six of his Red Arms. Killed by a... man, the power would not touch.
"I found it!"
Elaine shouted excitedly. She strode back out into the hall, holding a wide round bundle of rotted cloth she would not let Vannon take from her. Coated in gray from head to toe, she looked as if she had lain down and rolled in the dust.
"We have the Bowl of the Winds, Nynaeve!"
"In that case," Matt announced, "we are bloody well getting out of here now." Nobody argued. Oh, Nynaeve and Elaine insisted on all the men making sacks out of their jackets for things they rooted out of the room. They even loaded the wise women down, and themselves. And Rihanna had to go down and recruit men to carry their dead down the boat landing. But nobody argued. He doubted if the Rahad had ever seen as odd a procession as made its way to the river, or one that moved more quickly. Chapter 39. Promises to Keep.
"We are bloody well getting out of here now," Matt said again later, and this time there was argument.
There had been argument for the past half hour, near enough. Outside, the sun was past its noon peak. The trade winds cut the heat a little. Stiff yellow curtains fastened over the tall windows bulged and snapped at gusts. 3 hours back in the Tarasin Palace, the dice still bouncing in his head, and he wanted to kick something. Or somebody. He tugged at the scarf tied around his neck. It felt as though the rope that had given him the scar under that scarf was back and tightening slowly.
"Love of the light, are you all blind? Or just deaf?"
The room Tylan had provided was large, with green walls and high blue ceiling, and no furnishings but gilded chairs and small tables set with pearl shell, yet it was crowded even so. It seemed so, anyway. Tylan herself sat before one of the three marble fireplaces with her knees crossed, watching him with those dark eagle's eyes and a small smile, idly kicking her layered blue and yellow petticoats, idly toying with the jeweled hilt of her curved knife. He suspected Elaine or Nynaeve had spoken to her. They were there, too, seated to either side of the queen, somehow in clean dresses and apparently even bathed, though they had only been out of his sight for minutes at a stretch since returning to the palace. They almost matched Tylan for regal dignity in their bright silks. He was not sure who they wanted to impress with all that lace and elaborate embroidery. They looked ready for a royal ball, not a journey. He himself was still in his muck, with his dusty green coat hanging open, and the silver fox head caught in the neck of his half-undone shirt. Knotting the leather cord had shortened it, but he wanted the medallion touching his skin. He was around women who could channel, after all. Truth, those three women could probably have crowded the room by themselves. Tylan could have done it by herself, so far as he was concerned. If Nynaeve or Elaine had spoken to her, it was a very good thing that he was going. They three could have done it alone, but...
"This is preposterous," Marilla announced. "I've never heard of any shadowspawn called a golem. Have any of you?"
That was directed to Adelius and Vandine, Saritha and Karyana. Facing Tylan, the cool-eyed Aes Sedai serenity of all five made a fair job of turning their high-backed armchairs into thrones. He could not understand why Nynaeve and Elaine just sat like lumps, coolly serene too, but absolutely silent. They knew, they understood, and for some reason Marilla and that lot slathered their tongues with meekness for them now. Matt Cawthon, on the other hand, was a hairy-eared lout who needed to be kicked, and from Marilla on down, they were all ready to do the kicking.
"I saw the thing," he snapped. "Elaine saw the thing. Rihanna and the wise women saw it. Ask any of them."
Gathered at the end of the room, Rihanna and the five surviving wise women shrank back like huddling hens, afraid of actual questions. All but Sameko, anyway. Thumbs tucked behind her long red belt, the round woman kept frowning at the Aes Sedai, then shaking her head, frowning, then shaking her head. Nynaeve had a considerable talk with her in the privacy of the cabin on the boat coming back, and Matt thought that had something to do with her newfound attitude. He had caught mention of Aes Sedai more than once. Not that he had been trying to eavesdrop. The rest seemed to be wondering whether they should offer to fetch tea. Only Sameko had even appeared to consider the offer of a chair. Sabella, flapping bony arms in shock, had nearly fainted.
"No one denies the word of Elaine Aes Sedai, Master Cawthon," said Ranila Din Kalon Bluestar in a cool, deep voice.
Even had the dignified woman in silks to match the red and yellow floor tiles not been named to him earlier, the old memories meshed into his own would have identified her as Windfinder to the mistress of the ships by the 10 fat gold rings in her earlobes, those in each ear connected by a golden chain and half hidden by the narrow wings of white in her straight black hair. The medallions clustered along the finer chain that ran to her nose ring would tell him what clan she came from, among other things. So would the tattoos on her slim dark hands.
"What we question is the danger," she continued. "We do not like leaving the water without good cause."
Nearly 20 seafolk women stood gathered behind her chair, a riot of colorful silks and earrings and medallions on chains for the most part. The first odd thing he had noticed about them was their attitude toward the Aes Sedai. They were perfectly respectful, on the surface at any rate, but he had never before seen anyone look at Aes Sedai smugly. The second odd thing came from those other men's memories. He did not know a great deal about the seafolk from them, but enough. Every Atha An Mier, man or woman, began as the lowest deckhand, whether they were destined one day to become the master of the blades or the mistress of the ships herself. And every step of the way between, the seafolk were sticklers for rank, to make any king or Aes Sedai look a sloven. The women behind Renala were a peculiar lot by any measure. Windfinders to wave mistresses rubbing shoulders with windfinders from Sorers, by their medallions. But two wore bright blouses of plain wool above the dark oily breeches of deckhands, each with a single thin ring in her left ear. A second and third ring in the right indicated they were being trained as windfinders, but with two more to earn, not to mention the nose ring, it would be a long while yet that either would find herself called to haul sail whenever the deckmaster needed her, and find the deckmaster's flail across her rump if she did not move quickly enough. Those two did not belong in this gathering by any memory he had. Normally the windfinder to the mistress of ships would not even have spoken to one of them.
"Very much as I said, Renila," Marilla said, icily condescending.
She had certainly noticed those smug glances. That tone did not change as she shifted her attention to him.
"Do not grow petulant, Master Cawthon. We are willing to listen to reason, if you have any."
Matt gathered patience. He hoped he could find enough. Maybe if he used both hands and both feet.
"Golam were created in the middle of the War of the Power. During the Age of Legends," he began from the beginning.
Almost from the beginning of what Brigida had told him. He turned, facing each group of women as he spoke. Burn him if he was going to let one bunch think they were more important. Or that he was bloody pleading with them. Especially since he was.
"They were made to assassinate Aes Sedai. No other reason. To kill people who could channel. The one power won't help you. The power won't touch a golem. In fact, they can sense the ability to channel, if they're within, say, 50 paces of you. They can feel the power in you, too. You won't know the golem until it's too late. They look just like anybody else. On the outside. Inside. Golem have no bones. They can squeeze themselves under a door. And they're strong enough to rip a door off steel hinges with one hand.
Or rip out a throat. Light, he should have let Nelisian stay in bed." Suppressing a shiver, he pressed on. The women, all of them, watched him, almost not appearing to blink. He would not let them see him shiver.
"There were only 6 golem made, 3 male and 3 female. At least, that's what they look like. Apparently even the Forsaken were a little uneasy about them, or maybe they just decided 6 was enough. Either way, we know one is in Ebu Dar, probably kept alive since the breaking in a stasis box. We don't know if any others were put into that box, but one is more than enough. Whoever sent him, and it had to be one of the Forsaken, knew to follow us across the river. He had to have been sent after the Bowl of the Winds, and by what he said to me, to kill Nynaeve or Elaine, maybe both."
He spared them a quick look, soothing and sympathetic. Nobody could feel easy knowing that thing was after them. In return, he received a puzzled frown from Elaine, just the smallest wrinkling of her forehead, and from Nynaeve a slight wave of the hand, an impatient wave, to get on with it.
"To continue," he said, shooting the pair of them a glare. It was very hard not to sigh, dealing with women.
Whoever sent the golem has to know the bowl is here in the Tarasin Palace now. If he or she sends the golem here, some of you are going to die. Maybe a lot of you. I can't protect all of you at once. Maybe he'll get the bowl, too. And that's on top of Thalian Boda. Small chance she's alone, even with Isban a prisoner, so that means we have the Black Adja to worry about as well. Just in case the Forsaken and the Golem aren't enough for you. Rihanna and the Wise Women drew themselves up even more indignantly than Marilla and her friends at the mention of the Black Adja, and the Aes Sedai, stiffening and gathering skirts, looked ready to stalk out in a huff. Press on. That was all he could do. Now do you see why you all have to leave the palace and take the bowl somewhere the Golem doesn't know about? Somewhere the Black Adja doesn't know? Do you see why it has to be done now? Renila's sniff would have startled geese in the next room.
You merely repeat yourself, Master Cawthon.
Marilla Sedai says she has never heard of this Golem. Elaine Sedai says there was a strange man, a creature, but little else.
What is this stasis box? You have not explained that. How do you know what you claim to know?
Why should we go any further from the water than we are on the word of a man who creates fables from air?
Matt looked to Nynaeve and Elaine, though with little hope. If they would only open their mouths, this could have been finished long since, but they gazed back at him, practicing expressionless Aes Sedai masks, till their jaws must be creaking. He could not understand their silence. A bare-bones account of events in the Rahad had been all they gave, and he was willing to bet they would not have mentioned the Black Adja at all had there been any other way to explain showing up in the palace with an Aes Sedai bound and shielded. Isban was being held in another part of the palace, her presence known only to a handful. Nynaeve had forced some concoction down her throat, a foul-smelling mix of herbs that bulged the woman's eyes going down, and had her giggling and stumbling in short order, and the rest of the knitting circle occupied the room with her for guards. Unwilling guards, but very assiduous. Nynaeve made it extremely clear that should they let Isban get away, they had best start running before she laid hands on them again. He very carefully did not look toward Brigitta, standing beside the door with Avienda. The Aiel woman wore an Ebudari dress, not the plain wool she had returned in, but a silver-gray silk riding dress that jarred with her plain-sheathed, horn-handled belt knife. Brigitta had been quick to shed her own dress for her usual short coat and wide trousers, these dark blue and dark green. A quiver already hung at her hip. She was the source of everything he knew about Golem, and stasis boxes, except what his eyes had seen in the Rahad, and he would not have revealed that on a hot grill. "I read a book once that talked about—" he began, and Renila cut him off.
"A book?" she sneered.
"I will not abandon the salt for a book Aes Sedai do not know."
Suddenly it struck Matt that he was the only man present. Lan had gone off at Nynaeve's command, gone as tamely as Beslan had at his mother's. Tom and Julin were packing to leave, had probably finished packing by now. If there was any use to it, if they ever did leave— The only man, surrounded by a wall of women who apparently intended to let him beat his head against that wall, till his brains were scrambled. It made no sense. None. They looked at him, waiting. Nynaeve, in yellow-slashed, lace-trimmed blue, had pulled her braid over her shoulder so it hung down between her breasts. But that heavy gold ring, Lan's ring, he had learned, was carefully positioned to show anyway. Her face was smooth, and her hands rested in her lap, yet sometimes her fingers twitched. Elaine, in green Ebudari silk that made Nynaeve seem covered up despite the smoky lace collar under her chin, gazed back at him with eyes like cool pools of deep blue water. Her hands lay in her lap, too, but now and again she would begin to trace the thread of gold embroidery that covered her skirts, then immediately stop. Why did they not say something? Were they trying to get back at him? Was it just a case of, Matt wants to be in charge so much, let him see how well he can do without us? He might have believed it of Nynaeve, any time but this anyway, but not of Elaine, not anymore. So why? Rihanna and the Wise Women did not huddle away from him as they did from the Aes Sedai, but their manner toward him had changed. Tamarla gave him a decently respectful nod, Honey-haired Fumella went so far as a friendly smile. Strangely, Rihanna blushed, a pale stain. But they did not count as opposition, really. The six women had not said a dozen unprompted words between them since entering this room. Everyone would jump if Nynaeve or Elaine snapped her fingers, and keep jumping until told to stop. He turned to the rest of the Aes Sedai. Faces infinitely calm, infinitely patient. Except... Marilla's eyes flickered past him toward Nynaeve and Elaine for one instant. Saritha began slowly smoothing her skirts under his gaze, seemingly unaware of doing so. A dark suspicion bloomed in his mind. Hands moving on skirts, Rihanna's blush, Brigida's ready quiver. A murky suspicion. He did not really know of what, just that he had been going about this the wrong way. He gave Nynaeve a stern look, and Elaine a sterner. Butter would not have melted on their bloody tongues. Slowly he walked toward the sea folk. He just walked, but he heard someone with Marilla sniff, and Saritha muttered, "Such insolence!" Well, he was about to show them insolence. If Nynaeve and Elaine did not like it, they should have taken him into their confidence. Light, but he hated being used, especially when he did not know how or why. Stopping in front of Anila's chair, he studied the dark faces of the Atha Anmir women behind it before looking down to her. She frowned, stroking a knife set with moonstones thrust behind her sash. She was a handsome woman rather than pretty, somewhere in her middle years, and under different circumstances he might have enjoyed looking at her eyes. They were large black pools a man could spend an evening just gazing into. Under different circumstances. Somehow the sea folk were the fly in the cream pitcher, and he had not a clue how to pluck it out. He managed to keep his irritation under control, barely. What to bloody do? "You can all channel, I understand," he said quietly. "But that doesn't mean much to me. As well be straight from the start. You can ask Adelias or Vandine how much I care whether a woman can channel." Renila looked past him toward Tylin, but it was not to the queen she spoke. "Nynaeve Sedai," she said dryly, "I believe there was no mention in your bargain of my having to listen to this young oakum picker. I don't bloody care about your bargains with anybody else, you daughter of the sands," Matt snapped. So his irritation was not that well under control. A man could only take so much. Gasps rose among the women behind her. Something over 1,000 years ago, a seafolk woman had called an Essaninian soldier a son of the sands just before trying to plant a blade in his ribs. The memory lay tucked inside Matt Cawthon's head now. It was not the worst insult among the Atha Anmir, but it came close. Renata's face gorged with blood. Hissing, eyes bulging in fury, she leaped to her feet, that moonstone-studded dagger flashing in her fist. Matt snatched it out of her hand before the blade could reach his chest and shoved her back into her chair. He did have quick hands. He could still hold on to his temper, too. No matter how many women thought they could dance him for a puppet, he could... "You listen to me, you bilge-stone!" All right, maybe he could not hold it. "Nynaeve and Elaine need you, or I'd leave you for the golem to crack your bones and the black Aja to pick over what's left. Well, as far as you're concerned, I'm the master of the blades, and my blades are bare." What that meant exactly, he had no idea, except for having once heard, "When the blades are bare, even the mistress of the ships bows to the master of the blades." "This is the bargain between you and me. You go where Nynaeve and Elaine want, and in return, I won't tie the lot of you across horses like pack saddles and haul you there." That was no way to go on, not with the windfinder to the mistress of the ships. Not with a bilge boy off a broken-backed darter, for that matter. Renila quivered with the effort of not going for him with her bare hands, and never mind her dagger in his hand. "It is agreed, under the light," she growled. Her eyes nearly started out of her head. Her mouth worked, confusion and disbelief suddenly chasing one another across her face. This time, the gasps sounded as if the wind had ripped the curtains down. "It is agreed," Matt said quickly, and touching fingers to his lips, he pressed them to hers. After a moment, she did the same, fingers trembling against his mouth. He held out the dagger, and she stared dully at it before taking it from him. The blade went back into its jeweled sheath. It was not polite to kill someone you had sealed the bargain with. At least, not until the terms were fulfilled. Murmurs began among the women behind her chair, rising, and Renila stirred herself to clap her hands once. That silenced windfinders to wave mistresses as quickly as the two deckhands in training.
"I think I have just made a bargain with a Taviran," she said in that cool, deep voice.
The woman could teach Aes Sedai how to pull themselves together quickly.
"But one day, Master Cawthon, if it pleases the light, I think you will walk a rope for me."
He did not know what that meant, except that she made it sound unpleasant. He made his best leg. "All things are possible, if it pleases the light," he murmured. Courtesy paid, after all. But her smile was disturbingly hopeful. When he turned back to the rest of the room, you would have thought he had horns and wings for the stairs. "Is there any further argument?" he asked in a wry tone, and did not wait for answers. "I thought not. In that case, I suggest you pick out some spot well away from here, and we can be on our way as soon as you bundle up your belongings." They made a show of discussion. Elaine mentioned Camelin, sounding at least half-serious, and Kariana suggested several remote villages in the Black Hills, all easily reached by Gateway. Light anywhere was easily reached by Gateway. Van Deen spoke of Arafel, and Avienda suggested Roydian in the Aiel Waste, with the seafolk women growing glummer the farther from the sea where the place is named. All a show. To Matt, at least, that was clear by Nynaeve's impatient fiddling with her braid, despite the suggestions coming hot and fast.
"If I may speak, Aes Sedai," Rihanna said timidly at last. She even raised her hand. "The kin maintain a farm on the other side of the river, a few miles north. Everyone knows it is a retreat for women who need contemplation and quiet, but no one connects it to us. The buildings are large and quite comfortable, if there's any need to stay long, and..."
"Yes," Nynaeve broke in. "Yes, I think that sounds just the thing. What do you say, Elaine?"
"I think it sounds wonderful, Nynaeve. I know Renila will appreciate staying close to the sea."
The other five sisters practically piled on top of her, saying how agreeable it sounded, how superior to any other suggestion. Matt rolled his eyes to the heavens. Tylin was a study in not seeing what lay under her nose, but Renila snapped at it like a trout taking a lace wing. Which was the point, of course. For some reason, she was not to know that Nynaeve and Elaine had had everything arranged beforehand. She led the rest of the seafolk women out to gather whatever belongings they had brought, before Nynaeve and Elaine could change their minds. Those two would have followed Marilla and the other Aes Sedai, but he crooked a finger at them. They exchanged glances. He would have had to talk an hour to say as much as passed in those looks. Then, somewhat to his surprise, came to him. Avienda and Brigida watched from the door, Tylin from her chair.
"I am very sorry to have used you,"
Elaine said before he could get a word out. Her smile flashed that dimple at him.
"We did have reasons, Matt. You must believe that."
"Which you do not need to know," Nynaeve put in firmly, flipping her braid back over her shoulder with a practiced toss of her head that made the gold ring bounce on her bosom. "Lan must be insane.
I must say, I never expected you to do what you did. Whatever in the world made you think of trying to bully them? You could have ruined everything."
"What's life if you don't take a chance now and then?" he said blithely. As well by him if they thought it was planned instead of temper. But they had used him again without telling him, and he wanted a bit back for that. "Next time you have to make a bargain with the sea folk, let me make it for you. Maybe that way it won't turn out as badly as the last one." Spots of color blooming in Nynaeve's cheeks told him he had hit the mark squarely. Not bad shooting, blindfolded. Elaine, though, just murmured,
"A most observant subject," in tones of rueful amusement.
Being in her good books might turn out less comfortable than being in her bad. They swept toward the door without letting him say more. Well, he had not really thought they would explain anything. Both were Aes Sedai to the bone. A man learned to live with what he had to. Tylin had all but slipped from his mind, but he had not from hers. She caught him up before he took two steps. Nynaeve and Elaine paused at the door with Avienda and Brigitte watching. So they saw when Tylin pinched his bottom. Some things nobody could learn to live with. Elaine put on a face of commiseration, Nynaeve of glowering disapproval. Avienda fought laughter, none too successfully, while Brigida wore her grin openly. They all bloody knew.
Nynaeve thinks you're a little boy needing protection,
Tylan breathed up at him.
I know you are a grown man.
Her smoky chuckle made that the dirtiest comment he had ever heard. The four women by the door got to watch his face turn beet red.
I will miss you, Pigeon. What you did with Renila was magnificent. I do so admire masterful men.
I'll miss you too, he muttered. To his shock, that was simple truth. He was leaving Abudar just in time. But if we meet again, I'll do the chasing. She chortled at him, and those dark eagle's eyes almost glowed.
I admire masterful men, duckling, but not when they try being masterful with me.
Seizing his ears, she pulled his head down where she could kiss him. He never saw Nynaeve and the others go, and he walked out on unsteady legs, tucking his shirt back in. He had returned to fetch his spear from the corner and his hat. The woman had no shame, not a scrap of it. He found Tom and Julin coming out of Tylan's apartments, followed by Nerim and Lopin, Nalesian's stout man, who each lugged a large wicker pannier, made for a pack saddle. Loaded with his belongings, he realized. Julin carried Matt's unstrung bow and had his quiver slung on one shoulder. Well, she had said she was moving him.
I found this on your pillow, Tom said, tossing him the ring he had bought what seemed a year ago. A parting gift, it seems. There were lover's knots and some other flowers strewn over both pillows.
Matt jammed the ring onto his finger. It's mine, burn you. I paid for it myself. The old gleeman knuckled his mustaches and coughed in a failed effort to stifle a sudden wide grin. Julin snatched off that ridiculous Terrabonner hat and became engrossed in studying the inside of it.
Blood and flaming. Matt drew a deep breath. I hope you two spared a moment for your own belongings, he said levelly, because as soon as I grab Alver, we're on our way, even if we happen to leave a moldy harp or a rusty swordbreaker behind.
Julin tugged at the corner of his eye with one finger, whatever that was supposed to mean, but Tom actually frowned. Insults to Tom's flute or his harp were insults to himself.
My lord,
Lopin said mournfully. He was a dark, balding man, rounder than Sumeiko, and his black tyrant commoner's coat, tight to the waist, then flaring, like Julin's, fit very tightly indeed. Normally almost as solemn as Nerim, now he had reddened eyes, as though he had been weeping.
My lord, is there any chance I might remain to see Lord Nalesian buried? He was a good master.
Matt hated saying no. Anybody left behind might be left for a long time, Lopin, he said gently. Listen, I'll need someone to help look after Alvar. Nerim has his hands full with me. For that matter, Nerim will go back to Telmanis, you know. If you'd like, I will take you on myself. He had grown used to having a manservant, and these were hard times for a man hunting work.
I would like that very much, my lord, the fellow said lugubriously. Young Ulver reminds me much of my youngest sister's son.
Only when they entered Matt's former rooms, the Lady Rosella was there, much more decently clothed than when he had last seen her, and quite alone.
Why should I have kept him tied to me?
She said, that truly marvelous bosom heaving with emotion as she planted her fists on her hips. The Queen's duckling, it seemed, was not supposed to take a snappish tone with the Queen's attendants.
Clip a boy's wings too far, and he will never grow to a proper man. He read his pages aloud, sitting on my knee. He might have read all day, had I allowed it. And did his numbers, so I let him go. Why are you in such a bother? He promised to return by sunset. And he seems to set a great store by his promises.
Propping the Ashandarai in its old corner, Matt told the other men to drop their burdens and go find Vannin and the remaining Red Arms. Then he left Rosella's spectacular bosom and ran all the way to the rooms Nynaeve and the other women shared. They were all there, in the sitting room, and so was Lan, with his warder's cloak already draped down his back and saddlebags on his shoulders. His saddlebags, and Nynaeve's, it seemed. A good many bundles of dresses and not-so-small chests stood about the floor. Pat wondered if they would make Lan carry those, too.
"Of course you have to go find him, Matt Cawthon," Nynaeve said. "Do you think we would just abandon the child?"
To hear her, you would have thought that was exactly what he had intended. Suddenly, he was deluged with offers of help, not just Nynaeve and Elaine proposing to put off going to the farm, but Lan and Brigitte and Avienda offering to join the search. Lan was stone-cold about it, grim as ever, but Brigitte and Avienda...
"My heart would break if anything happened to that boy," Brigitte said,
and Avienda added, just as warmly,
"I have always said you do not care for him properly."
Matt ground his teeth. In the streets of the city, Alvar might well elude 8 men until he appeared back at the palace at sunset. He did keep his promises, but small chance he would give up 1 moment of freedom he did not have to. More eyes would mean a quicker search, especially if all the wise women were brought into it. For the space of 3 heartbeats, he hesitated. He had his own promises to keep, though he was wise enough not to put it that way. "The bowl is too important," he told them. "That Golem is still out there, and maybe Mogedion, and the Black Hodja for sure." The dice thundered in his head. Avienda would not appreciate being lumped in with Nynaeve and Elaine, but he did not care right then. He addressed Lan and Brigitte. "Keep them safe until I can reach you. Keep all of them safe." Startlingly, Avienda said,
"We will. I promise."
She fingered the hilt of her knife. Apparently, she did not understand she was one of those to be kept safe. Nynaeve and Elaine did. Nynaeve's sudden glare tried to bore a hole through his skull. He expected her to yank on her braid, but strangely, her hand only fluttered toward it before being put firmly to her side. Elaine contented herself with raising her chin, those big blue eyes frosty. No dimple here. Lan and Brigitte understood, too.
"Nynaeve is my life," Lan said simply, putting a hand on her shoulder.
The odd thing was, she suddenly looked very sad, and then, just as suddenly, her jaw set as though she was preparing to walk through a stone wall and make a large hole. Brigitte gave Elaine a fond look, but it was to Matt she spoke.
"I will," she said. "Honor's truth."
Matt tugged at his coat uncomfortably. He still was not sure how much he had told her while drunk. Light but the woman could soak it up like dry sand. Even so, he gave the proper response for a Barashandan lord, accepting her pledge. "The honor of blood, the truth of blood." Brigitte nodded, and from the startled looks he received from Nynaeve and Elaine, she still kept his secrets close. Light, if any Aes Sedai ever found out about those memories, they might as well know he had blown the horn as well. Foxhead or no foxhead, they would stretch him out till they dug out every last why and how. As he was turning to go, Nynaeve caught his sleeve.
"Remember the storm, Matt.
It's going to break soon, I know it.
You take care of yourself, Matt Cawthon. Do you hear me?
Tylan has directions for the farm when you get back with Alvar." Nodding, he made his escape, the dice in his head like echoes of his running boots. Was it during this search that he was supposed to take care of himself, or while getting the directions from Tylan? Nynaeve and her listening to the wind. Did she think a little rain was going to melt him? Come to think, once they used the bowl of the winds, it would rain again. It seemed years since rain last fell. Something tugged at his thoughts, something about the weather, and Elaine, which made no sense, but he shrugged it off. One thing at a time, and the one thing right now was Alvar. The men were all waiting in the Red Arm's long room near the stables, everyone on their feet except Vannin, who lay sprawled on one of the beds with his fingers laced over his belly. Vannin said a man had to take rest when he could. He swung his boots over and sat up when Matt entered, though. He cared about Alvar as much as the others did. Matt was just afraid the man was going to start teaching him how to steal horses and poach pheasants. 7 sets of eyes focused on Matt intently. "Rosella said Alvar's wearing his red coat," he told them. "He gives them away sometimes, but any urchin you see in a good red coat probably knows where Alvar last was. Everybody goes in a different direction. Make loops out from the Malhara, and try to be back after about an hour. Wait till everybody is back before you go out again. That way, if somebody finds him, the rest of us won't still be looking tomorrow. Does everybody understand?" They nodded. Sometimes it amazed him. Lanky Tom, with his white hair and mustaches, who had been a queen's lover once, and more willingly than himself, not to mention more than a lover, if you believed half he said. Square-jawed Harnan, with that tattoo on his cheek, and more elsewhere, who had been a soldier all his life. Julin, with his bamboo staff and his sword-breaker on his hip, who thought himself as good as any lord, even if the idea of carrying a sword himself still made him uneasy. And Fat Vannon, who made Julin look a bootlicker by comparison. Skinny Fergan and Gorderan, nearly as wide in the shoulders as Perrin, and Metwin, whose pale Carianan face still looked like a boy's despite being years older than Matt. Some of them followed Matt Cawthon because they thought he was lucky, because his luck might keep them alive when the swords were out. And some for reasons he was not really sure of, but they followed. Not even Tom had ever more than protested an order of his. Maybe Ranila had been more than luck. Maybe his being Tavirin did more than dump him in the middle of trouble. Suddenly he felt responsible for these men. It was an uncomfortable feeling. Matt Cawthon and responsibility did not go together. It was unnatural. "Take care of yourselves and look sharp," he said. "You know what's out there. There's a storm coming." Now why had he said that? "Move! We're wasting light." The wind still blew strongly, sweeping dust across the Mulhalla Square, with its statue of a long-dead queen posing above the fountain, but there was no other sign of a storm. Narayeen had been noted for her honesty, but not enough to have been depicted completely bare-chested. The afternoon sun burned high in a sky without a cloud, but people rushed through the square as quickly as they had in the morning cool. That was gone, wind or no, down here on the ground. The paving stones seemed a griddle under his boots. Glaring across the square at the wandering woman, Matt headed toward the river. Alvar had not gone off with the street urchins half as often while they were staying at the inn. He had been too content ogling the serving girls and Sitala Anand's daughters. So much for the dice telling him he had to move into the palace. Anything he had done since leaving, anything he wanted to do, he amended, thinking of Tylan and her eyes and her hands, any of it could have been done just as well from there. Those dice spun now, and he wished they would just go away. He tried to move quickly, dodging impatiently around trundling carts and wagons, cursing at lacquered sedan chairs and coaches that nearly ran him down, eyes darting in search of a red coat close to the ground, but the bustle in the streets slowed him to a meander, which was just as well, in truth. No point dashing by the boy without seeing him. Wishing he had brought Pips out of the palace stables, he frowned at the people streaming past. A man on horseback could have moved no faster in the throng, but up in the saddle he could have seen farther. Then again, asking questions from a saddle would have been awkward. Not many folk actually rode inside the city, and some people had a tendency to shy away from anyone on a horse. Always the same question. The first time he asked was at a bridge just below the Mulhara, of a fellow selling honey-baked apples from a tray hanging from a strap around his neck. "Have you seen a boy about so high in a red coat?" Alvar liked sweets. "Boy, my lord," the fellow said, sucking his few remaining teeth. "Seen a thousand boys. Don't remember no coat, though. Would my lord like one apple or two?" He scooped up two with bony fingers and pushed them at Matt. The way they gave under his fingers, they were softer than any baking could account for. "Did my lord hear about the riot?" "No," Matt said sourly, and pushed on. At the other end of the bridge, he stopped a plump woman with a tray of ribbons. Ribbons held no fascination for Alvar, but her red petticoats flashed beneath the skirt sewn up nearly to her left hip, and the cut of her bodice revealed rounded cleavage to equal Rosella's. "Have you seen a boy?" He heard about the riot from her, too, and from half the people he asked. That rumor, he suspected, had begun with events at a certain house in the Rahad that very morning. A wagon driver with her long whip coiled around her neck even told him the ride had been across the river, once she allowed, as how she never noticed boys unless they ran under her mules. A square-faced man who sold honeycomb, incredibly dry-looking honeycomb, said the riot had been down near the light tower at the end of the bay road, on the eastern side of the mouth of the bay, which was about as likely a place for riding as the middle of the bay itself. There were always 1,000 rumors in any city if you listened, and he was forced to listen to snatches of all of them, it seemed. One of the most remarkably pretty women he had ever seen, standing outside a tavern, Maylin was a serving girl at the Old Sheep, but her only task seemed to be standing outside to attract customers, which she certainly did, told him there had been a battle that morning in the Cordes Hills, west of the city, she thought. Or maybe in the Rano Hills, across the bay. Or maybe... Remarkably pretty, Maylin, but not very bright. Alvar might have watched her for hours, so long as she never opened her mouth. But she could not remember seeing any boy in a... What color coat had he said again? He heard about riots and battles. He heard about enough strange things seen in the sky, or the hills, to populate the Blight. He heard that the Dragon Reborn was about to descend on the city with thousands of men who could channel, that the Aiel were coming, an army of Aes Sedai. No, it was an army of White Cloaks. Pedra Nile was dead, and the children intended to avenge him, though why in Ebu Dar was not exactly clear. You might have thought the city would be hip-deep in panic with all the tales floating around, but the fact was, even those who told a tale usually only half believed it. So he heard all sorts of nonsense, but not a word about any boy in a red coat. A few streets from the river, he began hearing thunder, great hollow booms that seemed to roll in from the sea. People looked up curiously at the cloudless sky, scratched their heads, and went on about their business. So did he, questioning every seller of sweets or fruit he saw, and every pretty woman afoot. All to no avail. Reaching the long stone quay that ran the whole length of the riverside of the city, he paused, studying the gray docks stretching out into the river, and the ships tied to them. The wind blew strong, heaving vessels at their mooring lines, grinding them against the stone docks despite the bags stuffed with wool hung down between for fenders. Unlike horses, ships did not interest Alvar except as a way to go from here to there, and ships were men's business in Ebu Dar, even if the lading they carried often was not. Women on these docks would either be merchants keeping an eye on their goods or hard-armed members of the Cargo Loaders Guild, and there would be no sweet sellers here. About to turn away, he realized almost no one was moving. The docks usually bustled, yet on every ship he could see, crewmen lined the rails and had climbed into the rigging to stare toward the bay. Barrels and crates stood abandoned, while shirtless men and wiry women in green leather vests crowded together at the ends of the docks to peer between the ships, south, toward the thunder. Down that way, black smoke rose in thick towering columns, slanting sharply north on the wind. Hesitating only a moment, he trotted out along the nearest dock. At first, ships tied to the long fingers of stone to the south blocked his view of anything except the smoke. Because of the way the shoreline lay, though, each dock stuck out farther than the next down. Once he pushed into the murmuring crowd at the end, the broad river made an open path of choppy green water to the wave-tossed bay. At least 2 dozen ships were burning out on the wide expanse of the bay, maybe more, engulfed in flame from end to end. A number of others had already settled, only a bow or stern still above water, and that sliding under. Even as he looked, the bow of a broad 2-masted ship flying a large banner of red and blue and gold, the banner of Altara, suddenly flew apart with a roar, a boom like thunder, and fast-thickening tendrils of smoke wafted away in the wind as the vessel began settling by the head. Hundreds of vessels were in motion. Every craft in the bay, 3-masted seafolk rakers and skimmers and 2-masted soarers, coastal ships with their triangular sails, river ships under sail or sweep, some fleeing upriver, most trying to beat out to sea. Scores of other ships swanned into the bay before the wind, great bluff-bowed vessels as tall as any of the rakers, crashing through the rolling waves, throwing aside spray. His breath caught as he suddenly made out square-ribbed sails. "Blood and bloody ashes," he muttered in shock. "It's the flaming Shonchan." "Who?" demanded a stern-faced woman crowded next to him. A dark blue woolen dress of fine cut marked her a merchant as much as did the leather folder she carried for her bills of lading, or the guild pin over one breast, a silver quill pen. "It's the Aes Sedai," she announced in tones of conviction. "I know channeling when I see it. The Children of the Light will do for them, just as soon as they arrive. You'll see." A lanky, gray-haired woman in a grimy green vest twisted around to confront her, fingering the wooden hilt of her dagger. "Hold your tongue about Aes Sedai, you flaming penny-grubber, or I'll peel you and stuff a white cloak down your bleeding gullet!" Matt left them waving their arms and shouting at one another, and pushed clear of the crowd, running from the quay. Already he could see four huge creatures circling over the city to the south on great pinions, like those of a bat. Figures clung to the creatures' backs, apparently in some sort of saddles. Another flying creature appeared, and more. Below them, flames suddenly fountained above the rooftops with a roar. People ran now, buffeting Matt as he struggled through the streets.
"Over!"
he shouted, hoping to be heard above the other shouts from every side, and the screams.
"Over!"
Abruptly, everybody seemed to be heading the other way, battering past him. Stubbornly, he forced on against the tide, and came to a street where what all those folk fled from was made plain. A Shonchan column rushed by, 100 or more men in helmets like insects' heads, and armor of overlapping plates, all riding animals like cats the size of horses, but covered in bronze scales rather than fur. Leaning forward in their saddles, blue-streamered lances slanted, they galloped toward the Malhara without looking to either side. Though gallop was not quite the word for the way those creatures moved, the speed was right, but they flowed. It was time to be gone. Past time. As soon as he found... As the end of the column went by, a flash of red, waist-high, caught his eye among the crowd in the street beyond the intersection.
"Over!"
He darted across, almost on the heels of the last scaled creature, pushing into the crowd in time to see a wide-eyed woman snatch up a little girl in a red dress and run with the child clutched to her bosom. Wildly, Matt pressed ahead, shouldering people aside when they bumped into him, bumping into more than a few himself.
"Over! Over!"
Twice more he saw a column of fire rise briefly above the rooftops, and smoke drifted to the sky in a dozen places. Twice more he saw a column of fire rise briefly above the rooftops, and smoke drifted to the sky in a dozen places. Several times he heard those booming roars, much closer than the bay now. Inside the city, he was sure. More than once the ground quivered beneath his boots. And then the street was clearing again, people fleeing in every direction, down alleys and into houses and shops, for Shonchan on horses were coming. Not all were armored men. Near the head of that small thicket of lances rode a dark woman in a blue dress. Matt knew the large red panels on her skirts and bosom were worked with silver lightning. A silver leash, gleaming in the sun, ran from her left wrist to the neck of a woman in gray, a Damani, who trotted beside the Suldam's horse like a pet dog. He had seen more of Shonchan at Falma than he wanted to, but unconsciously he paused at the mouth of an alleyway, watching. The roars and fires had showed that somebody in the city was trying to fight back, at least, and now he was going to see such an attempt. The Shonchan were not the only reason everyone else had gotten out of sight. At the other end of the street, a good 100 mounted men swung long-pointed lances down. They wore baggy white breeches and green coats, and the gold cords on the officer's helmet glittered. With a collective shout, 100 or more of Thailand's soldiers hurled themselves toward the city's attackers. They outnumbered the Shonchan in front of them by at least 2-1.
"Bloody fools," Matt muttered. "Not like that. That Suldam will..."
The only movement among the Shonchan was the woman in the lightning-marked dress raising her hand to point, as one might launch a hawk or send off a hound. The golden-haired woman at the other end of the silvery leash took a small step forward. The foxhead medallion cooled against his chest. Underneath the head of the Ebudari charge, the street suddenly erupted, paving stones and men and horses flying into the air with a deafening roar. The concussion knocked Matt flat on his back, or maybe it was the way the ground seemed to leap from under his feet. He pulled himself up in time to see the front of an inn across the way suddenly collapse into the street in a cloud of dust, exposing the rooms within. Men and horses lay everywhere, pieces of men and horses, those still alive thrashing, around a hole in the ground half as wide as the street. Screams from the wounded filled the air. Fewer than half the Ebudari staggered to their feet, dazed and stumbling. Some seized up the reins of horses, as wobbly-legged as they, heaving themselves into saddles, kicking the animals into some semblance of a run. Others just ran afoot, all away from the Shonchan. Steel they could face, but not this. Running, Matt realized, seemed a particularly fine idea right then. A glance back down the alley showed dust and rubble piled at least a story high. He darted down the street ahead of the fleeing Ebudari, keeping as close to the walls as possible, hoping none of the Shonchan would think he was one of Thailand's soldiers. He should never have worn a green coat. The Suldam apparently was not satisfied. The foxhead went cool again, and from behind another roar hammered him to the pavement, pavement that jumped up to meet him. Through the ringing in his ears, he heard masonry groan. Above him, the white-plastered brick wall began leaning outward.
"What happened to my bloody luck?"
he shouted. He had time for that, and just time to realize, as brick and timbers crashed down on him, that the dice in his head had just stopped dead.
Chapter 40 Spears. Mountains rose all around Galena Kasban, little more than large hills behind, but snow-capped peaks ahead, and higher peaks beyond those, yet she really saw none of them. The stones of the slope bruised her bare feet. She panted, lungs laboring already. The sun baked overhead as it had for seemingly endless days, burning the sweat out of her in rivers. Anything other than putting one foot in front of the other seemed beyond her. Strange that with all the sweat coming out of her, she could not find any moisture in her mouth. She had been Aes Sedai fewer than 90 years, her long black hair untouched as yet by gray, but for nearly 20 of those she had been head of the Red Aja, called the highest by other Red Sisters in private, considered by other Reds equal to the Ammerlin seat, and for all but 5 of the years she had worn the shawl, she had been of the Black Aja in truth. Not to the exclusion of her duties as a Red, but superior to them. Her place on the Supreme Council of the Black Aja was next to that of Alviarin herself, and she was one of only 3 who knew the name of the woman who led their hooded meetings. She could speak any name in those meetings, a king, and know that name belonged to the dead. It had happened with a king and with a queen. She had helped to break 2 Ammerlins, twice helped turn the most powerful woman in the world into a squealing wretch, eager to tell all she knew, had helped make it seem that one of those had died in her sleep, and had seen the other deposed and stilled. Such things were a duty, like the need to exterminate men with the ability to channel. Not actions she took pleasure in beyond that of tasks well done, but she had enjoyed leading the circle that stilled Swan Sanche. Surely all those things meant that Galena Kasban was herself among the mightiest of the world, among the most powerful. Surely they did. They must. Her legs wavered like springs that had lost their tempering, and she fell heavily, unable to catch herself with arms and elbows tightly bound behind her. The once white silk shift, the only garment left to her, tore again as she slid on the loose rocks, scraping her welts. A tree stopped her. Face pressed against the ground, she began to sob. "How?" she moaned in a thick voice. "How can this happen to me?" After a time, she realized that she had not been pulled to her feet. No matter how often she fell, she had never before been allowed a moment's respite. Blinking away tears, she raised her head. Aiel women covered the mountainside, several hundred of them scattered among the barren trees with their spears, the veils they could raise in an instant hanging down their chests. Galena wanted to laugh. Maidens. They called these monstrous women maidens. She wished she could laugh. At least there were no men present, a small mercy. Men made her skin crawl, and if one could see her now, less than half-clothed. Anxiously her eyes sought for Tarava, but most of the 70 or so wise ones stood together looking at something farther up the slope, blocking her view. There seemed to be a murmur of voices from the front of them. Maybe the wise ones were conferring about something. Wise ones. They had been brutally efficient in teaching her the correct names, never just Aiel woman, and never Wilder. They could smell contempt however she hid it. Of course you did not have to try hiding what had been seared out of you. Most of the wise ones were looking away, but not all. The glow of Sidar surrounded a young, pretty, red-haired woman with a delicate mouth, who watched Galena with large, intent blue eyes. Perhaps as a sign of their own disdain, they had chosen the weakest of their number to shield her this morning. Mikara was not truly weak in the power. None of them were that. But even smarting from shoulders to knees as she was, Galena could have broken Mikara's shield with little effort. A muscle in her cheek spasmed uncontrollably. It always did when she thought of another escape attempt. The first had been bad enough. The second... Shuddering, she fought not to sob again. She would not make the attempt again until she was sure of complete success. Very sure. Absolutely sure. The mass of wise ones parted, turning to follow Terava with their eyes as the hawk-faced woman strode toward Galena. Suddenly panting once more with apprehension, Galena tried to struggle to her feet. Hands bound and muscles watery, she had only reached her knees when Terava bent over her, necklaces of ivory and gold clattering softly. Seizing a handful of Galena's hair, Terava forced her head back sharply. Taller than most men, the woman did that even when they were standing, craning Galena's neck painfully to make her look up into the wise one's face. Terava was somewhat stronger in the power than she, which relatively few women were, but that was not what made Galena tremble. Cold, deep blue eyes stabbed into her own, held her more tightly than Terava's rough hand. They seemed to strip her soul naked, as easily as the wise one handled her. She had not begged yet, not when they made her walk all day with hardly a drop of water, not when they forced her to keep up as they ran for hours, not even when their switches made her howl. Terava's cruel, hard face, staring down at her impassively, made her want to beg. Sometimes she woke at night, stretched out tight between the four stakes where they bound her, woke whimpering from dreams that her whole life would be lived under Terava's hands. "She is collapsing already," the wise one said in a voice like stone. "Water her and bring her." Turning away, she adjusted her shawl. Galena Kasban forgotten until there was a need to recall her. To Terava, Galena Kasban was less important than a stray dog. Galena did not try to rise. She had been watered often enough by now. It was the only way they let her drink. Aching for moisture, she did not resist when a blocky maiden took her by the hair as Terava had and pulled her head back. She just opened her mouth as far as she could. Another maiden, with a puckered scar slanting across nose and cheek, tilted a water skin and slowly poured a trickle into Galena's waiting mouth. The water was flat and warm. It was delicious. She swallowed convulsively, awkwardly, holding her jaws wide. Almost as much as water to drink, she wanted to move her face under that thin stream, to let it run over her cheeks and forehead. Instead, she kept her head very steady, so that every drop went down her throat. Spilling water was cause for another beating. They had thrashed her in sight of a creek 6 paces wide for spilling a mouthful over her chin. When the water skin was finally taken away, the blocky maiden hauled her to her feet by her bound elbows. Galena groaned. The wise ones were gathering their skirts over their arms, exposing their legs well above soft knee-high boots. They could not be going to run. Not again. Not in these mountains. The wise ones loped forward as easily as if on level ground. An unseen maiden cut Galena across the back of her thighs with a switch, and she stumbled to a semblance of a run, half-dragged by the blocky maiden. The switch slashed her legs whenever they faltered. If this run continued the rest of the day, they would take turns, one maiden wielding the stick and another dragging. Laboring up slopes and nearly sliding down, Galena ran. A tawny mountain cat, striped in shades of brown and heavier than a man, snarled at them from a rocky ledge above. A female, lacking the tufts on her ears and the wide cheeks. Galena wanted to shout at her to flee, to run before Terava caught her. The Aiel ran on by the snarling animal, unconcerned, and Galena wept with jealousy for the cat's freedom. She would be rescued eventually, of course. She knew that. The tower would not allow a sister to remain in captivity. Elida would not allow a red to be held. Surely Alviarin would send rescue. Someone would, anyone, to save her from these monsters, especially from Terava. She would promise anything for that deliverance. She would even keep those promises. She had been broken free of the 3 oaths on joining the Black Aja, replacing them with a new trinity. But at that moment she truly believed she would keep her word if it brought rescue. Any promise to anyone who would free her, even a man. By the time low tents appeared, their dark colors fading into the forested mountainsides as well as the cat had, Galena had 2 maidens supporting her, pulling her along. Shouts rose from every side, glad cries of greeting, but Galena was dragged on behind the wise ones, deeper into the camp, still running, stumbling. Without warning, the hands left her arms. She pitched forward on her face and lay there with her nose in the dirt and dead leaves, sucking air through her gaping mouth. She coughed on a piece of leaf, but she was too weak to turn her head. The blood pounded her ears, but voices came to her and slowly began to make sense. "Took your time, Tarava," a familiar-sounding woman's voice said. "9 days. We have been back long since." 9 days? Galena shook her head, scrubbing her face on the ground. Since the Aiel had shot her horse from under her, memory blended all the days into a mélange of thirst and running and being beaten, but surely it had been longer ago than 9 days. Weeks, certainly. A month or more. "Bring her in," the familiar voice said impatiently. Hands pulled her up, shoved her forward, bending her to go under the edge of a large tent with the sides raised all around. She was thrown down on layered carpets, the edge of a red and blue Tyran maze overlapping gaudy flowers beneath her nose. With difficulty, she raised her head. At first, she saw nothing but Savannah, seated on a large yellow-tasseled cushion in front of her. Savannah, with her hair like fine spun gold, her clear emerald eyes. Treacherous Savannah, who had given her word to distract attention by raiding into Kyrian, then broken her pledge by trying to free Althor. Savannah, who at the least might take her from Tarava's clutches. She struggled up onto her knees and for the first time realized there were others in the tent. Tarava sat on a cushion to Savannah's right, at the head of a curving line of wise ones, 14 women who could channel in all, though Mikara, who still held the shield on her, stood at the foot of the line rather than sitting. Half of them had been among the wise ones who captured her with such scornful ease. She would never again be so careless about wise ones. Never again. Short, pale-faced men and women in white robes moved behind the wise ones, wordlessly offering trays of gold or silver with small cups, and more did the same on the other side of the tent, where a gray-haired woman in an Aiel coat and breeches of brown and gray sat to Savannah's left, at the head of a line of 12 stone-faced Aiel men. Men. And she wore nothing but her shift, ripped and gaping in a number of places. Galena clamped her teeth shut to stifle a scream. She forced her back stiff to keep from trying to burrow into the rugs and hide from those cold male eyes. "It seems that Aes Sedai can lie," Savannah said, and the blood drained from Galena's face. The woman could not know. She could not. "You made pledges, Galena Kasban, and broke them. Did you think you could murder a wise one and then run beyond the reach of our spears?" For a moment relief froze Galena's tongue. Savannah did not know about the Black Aja. Had she not abandoned the light long ago, she would have thanked the light. Relief stilled her tongue, and a tiny spark of indignation. "They attacked Aes Sedai, and were angry when some of them died?" A tiny spark was all she could manage. After all, what was Savannah's twisting facts alongside days of beatings and Tarava's eyes? A pained, croaking laugh bubbled up at the absurdity of it. Her throat was so dry. "Be thankful some of you still live," she managed past her laughter. "Even now it is not too late to rectify your mistakes, Savannah." With an effort she swallowed rueful mirth before it turned to tears, just before. "When I return to the White Tower I will remember those who assist me, even now," she would have added, "and those who do otherwise," but Tirava's unwavering stare set fear fluttering in her middle. For all she knew, Tarava still might be allowed to do whatever she wished. There had to be some way to induce Savannah to take charge of her. That tasted bitter, yet anything was better than Tarava. Savannah was ambitious and greedy. In the midst of frowning at Galena, she had caught sight of her own hand and directed a brief admiring smile at rings set with large emeralds and fire drops. She wore rings on half her fingers, and necklaces of pearls and rubies and diamonds fit for any queen draped across the swell of her bosom. Savannah could not be trusted, but perhaps she could be bought. Tarava was a force of nature, as well try to buy a flood or an avalanche. I trust that you will do what is right, Savannah, she finished. The rewards of friendship with the White Tower are great. For a long moment there was silence except for the whisper of the white robes as the servants moved with their trays. Then, you are Datsang, Savannah said. Galina blinked. She was a despised one? Certainly they had displayed their contempt plainly, but why? You are Datsang, a round-faced wise one she did not know intoned, and a woman a hand taller than Tarava repeated, You are Datsang. Tarava's hawk-like face might have been carved from wood, yet her eyes fixed on Galina glittered accusingly. Galina felt nailed to the spot where she knelt, unable to move a muscle. A hypnotized bird watching a serpent slither nearer. No one had ever made her feel that way. No one. Three wise ones have spoken. Savannah's satisfied smile was almost welcoming. Tarava's face was stark. The woman did not like whatever had just happened. Something had happened, even if Galina did not know what. Except that it appeared to have delivered her from Tarava. That was more than enough for the moment. More than enough. When maidens cut her bounds and stuffed her into a black wool robe, she was so grateful she almost did not care that they tore off the remnants of her shift first, in front of those ice-eyed men. The thick wool was hot and itchy and scratchy on her welts, and she welcomed it as though it were silk. Despite Mikara still shielding her, she could have laughed as the maidens led her out of the tent. It did not take long for that desire to vanish entirely. It did not take her long to begin wondering whether begging on her knees before Savannah would do any good. She would have done it, could she have gotten to the woman, except that Mikara made it plain she was not going anywhere she was not told to go, or speak a word unless spoken to. Arms folded, Savannah watched the Aes Sedai, the Datsang, stagger down the mountainside and stop, beside a maiden squatting on her heels with a switch, to drop the head-shaped stone she had been carrying in her hands. The black hood turned in Savannah's direction for a moment, but the Datsang quickly bent to pick up another large stone and turned to labor back up the 50 paces to where Mikara waited with another maiden. There she dropped that stone, picked up another, and started back down. Datsang were always shamed with useless labor. Unless there was great need, the woman would not be allowed to carry even a cup of water, yet toil without purpose would fill her hours till she burst of shame. The sun had a long way to climb yet, and many more days lay ahead. I did not think she would condemn herself out of her own mouth, Riala said at Savannah's shoulder. Ephalin and the others are all but sure she openly admitted killing Desane. She is mine, Savannah. Tarava's jaw tightened. She might have taken the woman, but Datsang belonged to no one. I intended to dress her in Gaishine robes of silk, she muttered. What is the purpose of this, Savannah? I expected to have to argue against cutting her throat, not this. Riala tossed her head, casting a sidelong glance at Savannah. Savannah intends to break her. We have had long talks of what to do should we capture any Aes Sedai. Savannah wants a tame Aes Sedai to wear white and serve her. An Aes Sedai in black will do well enough, though. Savannah shifted her shawl, irritated by the woman's tone. Not quite mocking, but all too aware that she wanted somehow to use the Aes Sedai's channeling as though it were Savannah's own. It would be possible. Two guys shined past the three wise ones, carrying a large brass-strapped chest between them. Short and pale-faced, husband and wife, they had been lord and lady in the tree-killer's lands. The pair bowed their heads more meekly than any Aiel in white ever could have managed. Their dark eyes were tight with fear of a harsh word, much less a switch. Wetlanders could be tamed like horses. "The woman is tamed already," Tarava grumbled. I have looked into her eyes. She is a bird fluttering in the hand and afraid to fly. In 9 days, Riala said incredulously, and Savannah shook her head vigorously. She is Aes Sedai, Tarava. You saw her face go pale with fury when I accused her. You heard her laugh as she spoke of killing wise ones. She made a vexed, angry sound. And you heard her threaten us. The woman had been as slippery as the tree killers, speaking of rewards and letting the threat, if no rewards came, shout silently. But what else could be expected of Aes Sedai? It will take long to break her, but this Aes Sedai will beg to obey if it takes a year. Once she did that, Aes Sedai could not lie, of course. She had expected Galena to deny her accusation. Once she swore to obey...
"If you want to make an Aes Sedai obey you," a man's voice said behind her, "this might help."
Incredulous, Savannah spun about to find Kadar standing there, and beside him the woman, the Aes Sedai, Maesia, both dressed in dark silk and fine lace as they had been 6 days ago, each with a bulging sack hanging incongruously from one shoulder by a strap. Kadar held out a smooth white rod about a foot long in one dark hand. "How did you come here?" she demanded, then compressed her lips in anger. Plainly he had come as he had before. She was just surprised at him appearing here in the middle of the camp. She snatched the white rod he offered, and as always he stepped back beyond arm's reach. "Why have you come?" she amended. "What is this?" A little slimmer than her wrist, the rod was smooth except for a few odd flowing symbols incised on one flat end. It felt not quite like ivory, not quite like glass, very cool to the touch.
"You might call it an oath rod," Kadar said, showing teeth in what was doubtless meant for a smile. "It only came into my hands yesterday, and I immediately thought of you."
Savannah clamped her hands tight around the rod to keep from hurling it away. Everyone knew what the Aes Sedai's oath rod did. Trying not even to think, much less speak, she thrust it behind her belt and took her hands away. Riala frowned at the rod at Savannah's waist, and her eyes rose slowly, coldly, to Savannah's face. Tarava adjusted her shawl in a clatter of bracelets and gave her a hard, thin smile. There would never be any chance of one of them touching the rod, and maybe no chance of any other wise one doing so either. But there was still Galena Caspan. One day she would break. Raven-eyed Maesia, a little behind Kadar, smiled almost as faintly as Tarava. She had seen and understood. She was observant for a wetlander. "Come," Savannah told Kadar. "We will drink tea in my tent." She certainly would not share water with him. Lifting her skirts, she started up the slope. To her surprise, Kadar was also observant.
"All you need do is have your Aes Sedai."
Walking easily beside her on his long legs, he grinned suddenly, toothily, at Riala and Tarava.
"Or any woman who can channel, hold the rod and speak whatever promises you wish, while someone channels a little spirit into the number.
The marks on the end of the rod," he added, raising his eyebrows insultingly.
"You can use it to release her, too, but that is more painful, or so I understand."
Savannah's fingers touched the rod lightly, more glass than ivory, and very cool. "It only works on women?" She ducked into the tent ahead of him. The wise ones and the leaders of the warrior societies were gone, but the dozen tree-killer Guy Shine remained, kneeling patiently to one side. No one person had ever kept a dozen Guy Shine before, and she possessed more. There would have to be a new name for them, though, since they would never put off the white.
"Women who can channel, Savannah," Kadar said, following her in.
The man's tone was incredibly insolent. His dark eyes shone with open amusement.
"You will have to wait until you have Althor before I give you what will control him."
Removing the sack from his shoulder, he sat. Not on a cushion near hers, of course. Maesia was not afraid of a blade in her ribs. She lounged on an elbow almost at Savannah's side. Savannah eyed her sideways, then casually undid another lace of her own blouse. She did not recall the woman's bosom being as round as that. For that matter, her face seemed even more beautiful as well. Savannah tried not to grind her teeth.
"Of course," Kadar went on, "if you mean some other man... There is a thing called a binding chair. Binding people who cannot channel is more difficult than binding those who can. Perhaps a binding chair survived the breaking, but you will have to wait while I find it."
Savannah touched the rod again, then impatiently ordered one of the Gaishine to bring tea. She could wait. Kadar was a fool. Sooner or later he would give her everything she wanted of him. and now the rod could break Maesia free of him. Surely then the woman would not protect him. For his insults he would wear black. Savannah took a small green porcelain cup from the tray the Gaishine held, and gave it to the Aes Sedai with her own hands. "It is flavored with mint, Maesia. You will find it refreshing." The woman smiled, but those black eyes... Well, what could be done to one Aes Sedai could be done to two or more. "What of the traveling boxes?" Savannah demanded curtly. Kadar waved the Gaishine away and patted the sack beside him. "I brought as many Narbaha, that is what they were called, as many as I could find. Enough to transport all of you by nightfall if you hurry. And I would if I were you. Althor means to finish you, it seems. Two clans are coming up from the south, and two more are moving to come down from the north, with their wise ones all ready to channel. Their orders are to stay until every last one of you is dead or a prisoner." Tirava sniffed. "A reason to move, certainly, Wetlander, but not to run. Even four clans cannot sweep Kinslayer's dagger in a day." "Didn't I say?" Kadar's smile was not at all pleasant. "It seems Althor has bound some Aes Sedai to him, too, and they have taught the wise ones how to travel without a Narbaha, over short distances at least, 20 or 30 miles. A recent discovery, it seems. They could be here, well, today. All four clans." Maybe he lied, yet the risk... Savannah could imagine all too well being in Cerulea's grip. Not allowing herself to shiver, she sent Riala to inform the other wise ones. Her voice betrayed nothing. Reaching into his bag, Kadar drew out a gray stone cube, smaller than the call box she had used to summon him, and much plainer, with no marking but a bright red disk set in one face. "This is a Narbaha," he said. "It uses Sidene, so none of you will see anything, and it has limits. If a woman touches it, it won't work for days afterward, so I will have to hand them out myself. And it has other limits. Once opened, the gateway will remain for a fixed time, sufficient for a few thousand to go through if they don't waste time, and the Narbaha needs 3 days to recover afterward. I have enough extra to carry us where we need to go today, but..." Tirava leaned forward so intently she looked about to fall over, but Savannah hardly listened. She did not doubt Kadar exactly. He would not dare betray them, not while he hungered for the gold the Shido would give him. There were small things, though. Maesia seemed to study him over her tea. Why? And if there was such need for speed, why was there no urgency in his voice? He would not betray, but she would take precautions anyway.
Merrick frowned at the stone cube the Wetlander had given him, then at the hole that had appeared when he pressed the red spot. A hole 5 paces wide and 3 high in midair. Beyond lay rolling hills, not low, covered with brown grass. He did not like things to do with the One Power, especially the male part of it. Savannah stepped through another smaller hole, with the Wetlander and a dark woman, following the wise ones Savannah and Riala had chosen out. Only a handful of wise ones remained with the Moshen Shido. Through that second hole, he could see Savannah talking with Bendwin. The Green Salt's Sept would find themselves with few wise ones, too. Merrick was sure of it. Dyrella touched his arm.
"Husband,"
she murmured. "Savannah said it would only remain open a short while." Merrick nodded. Dyrella always saw straight to the point. Veiling himself, he ran forward and leaped through the hole he had made. Whatever Savannah and the Wetlander said, he would send none of his Moshane through before he knew it was safe. He landed heavily on a slope covered with dead grass and nearly pitched head over heels down the hill before he caught himself. For a moment, he stared back up at the hole. On this side, it hung more than a foot above the ground.
"Wife!"
he shouted.
"There is a drop!"
Black eyes leaped through, veiled and spears ready, and maidens also. As well try to drink sand as try to keep maidens from being among the first. The rest of the Moshane followed at a run, Algaitsiswai and wives and children, jumping down on the fly. Craftsfolk and traders and Gaishine, most pulling heavily loaded pack horses and mules, near to 6,000 altogether.
His sept, his people. They still would be, once he went to Roydian. Savanna could not keep him from becoming clan chief for much longer. Scouts began spreading out immediately, while the sept still rushed out of the hole. Lowering his veil, Merrick shouted orders that sent a screen of Algaid Siswai toward the crests of the surrounding hills, while everyone else remained concealed below. There was no telling who or what lay beyond those hills. Rich lands, the wetlander claimed, but this part did not look rich to him. The rush of his sept became a flood of Algaid Siswai he did not really trust. Men who had fled their own clans because they did not believe Randall Thor was truly the Karakarn. Merrick was not sure what he himself believed, but a man did not abandon sept and clan. These men called themselves Meridin, the Brotherless, a fitting name, and he had 200... The hole suddenly snapped into a vertical slash of silver that sliced through 10 of the Brotherless. Pieces of them fell onto the slope, arms, legs. The front half of a man slid almost to Merrick's feet. Staring at the place where the hole had been, he stabbed at the red spot with his thumb. Useless, he knew, but... Darin, his eldest son, was one of the stone dogs waiting as a rear guard. They would have been the last through. Surail, his eldest daughter, had remained with the stone dog for whom she was thinking of giving up the spear. His eyes met Dyrella's, as green and beautiful as the day she had laid the wreath at his feet, and threatened to cut his throat if he did not pick it up. "We can wait," he said softly. The wetlander had said 3 days, but maybe he was wrong. His thumb stabbed the red spot again. Dyrella nodded calmly. He hoped there would be no need to cry in one another's arms once they could be alone. A maiden came skittering down the slope from above, hurriedly lowering her veil and actually breathing hard.
"Merrick,"
Naissa said, not even waiting for him to see her.
"There are spears to the east, only a few miles and running straight at us. I think they are Rain. At least 7,000 or 8,000 of them."
He could see other Algaid Siswai running toward him. A young brother to the eagle Cairdan slid to a stop, speaking as soon as Merrick saw him.
"I see you, Merrick. There are spears no more than 5 miles to the north, and wetlanders on horses. Perhaps 10,000 of each. I do not think any of us broke the crest, but some of the spears have turned toward us."
Merrick knew before the grizzled water-seeker named Lairad opened his mouth.
"Spears coming over a hill 3 or 4 miles to the south. 8,000 or more. Some of them saw one of the boys."
Lairad never wasted words, and he would never say which boy, who in truth could be anyone without gray hair to Lairad. There was no time for wasting words, Merrick knew.
"Hamal!"
he shouted. No time for proper courtesy to a blacksmith, either. The big man knew something was wrong. He scrambled up the slope, likely moving faster than he had since first picking up a hammer. Merrick handed in the stone cube.
"You must press the red spot and keep pressing it no matter what happens, no matter how long it takes for that hole to open. That is the only way for any of you."
Hamal nodded, but Merrick did not even wait for him to say that he would. Hamal would understand. Merrick touched Dyrella's cheek, careless of how many eyes were on them.
"Shade of my heart, you must prepare to put on white."
Her hand strayed toward the hilt of her belt knife. She had been a maiden when she made his wreath, but he shook his head firmly.
"You must live, wife, roof mistress, to hold together what remains."
Nodding, she pressed fingers to his cheek. He was astonished. She had always been very reserved in public. Raising his veil, Merrick shoved one spear high above his head.
"Machine!"
he roared.
"We dance!"
Up the slope they followed him, men and maidens, nearly 1,000 strong, counting the Brotherless. Perhaps they could be counted among the sept. Up the slope and west. That way lay the nearest and the fewest. Perhaps they might buy enough time, though he did not really believe that. He wondered whether Savanna had known of this. Ah, the world had grown very strange since Randall Thor came. Some things could not change, though. Laughing, he began to sing.
"Wash the spears while the sun climbs high. Wash the spears while the sun falls low. Wash the spears, who fears to die?
wash the spears, no one I know.
Singing, the Moshane Shido ran to dance their deaths.
Frowning, Grendel watched the gateway close behind the last of the Jumai Shido. The Jumai and a great many wise ones. Unlike with the others, Samael had not simply knotted this web so it would fall apart eventually. At least, she assumed he held it to the last. The closing, right on the heels of the last brown and gray-clad men, was too fortuitous otherwise. Laughing, Samael tossed away the bag, still holding a few of those useless bits of stone. Her own empty sack was long since discarded. The sun sat low behind the mountains to the west, half of a glowing red ball. "One of these days," she said dryly, "you will be too smart for your own good." "A fool box, Samael? Suppose one of them had understood." "None did," he said simply, but he kept rubbing his hands together and staring at where the gateway had been, or maybe at something beyond. He still held the mask of mirrors, giving him the illusion of added height. She had dropped hers as soon as the gateway closed. "Well, you certainly managed to put a panic into them." Around them lay the evidence, a few low tents still standing, blankets, a cook pot, a rag doll, all sorts of rubbish lying where it had fallen. "Where did you send them? Somewhere ahead of Althor's army, I suppose?" "Some," he said absently. "Enough." His staring introspection vanished abruptly, and his disguise as well. The scar across his face seemed especially livid. Enough to cause trouble, particularly with their wise ones channeling, but not so many that anyone will suspect me. The rest are scattered from Ilion to Gildan. As to how or why, maybe Althor did it, for his own reasons, but I certainly wouldn't have wasted most of them if it was my work, now would I? He laughed again, caught up in his own brilliance. She adjusted the bodice of her dress to cover a start. Competing that way was remarkably silly. She had told herself that 10,000 times and never listened once. Remarkably silly. And now the dress felt as if it might fall off, which had nothing to do with her start. He did not know Savannah had taken every Shido woman who could channel with her. Was it finally time to abandon him? If she threw herself on Demondred's mercy, as if reading her thoughts, he said, "You're tied to me as tightly as my belt, Grendel." A gateway opened, revealing his private rooms in Ilion. "The truth doesn't matter any more, if it ever has. You rise with me or fall with me. The Great Lord rewards success, and he's never cared how it was achieved." "As you say," she told him. Demondred had no mercy. "And Semirag, I rise or fall with you." Still, something would have to be worked out. The Great Lord rewarded success, but she would not be pulled down if Samael failed. She opened a gateway to her palace in Arad Doman, to the long columned room where she could see her pets frolicking in the pool. "But what if Althor comes after you himself? What then?" "Althor isn't going after anyone," Samael laughed. "All I have to do is wait." Still laughing, he stepped into his gateway and let it close.
The Murdral moved from the deeper shadows, becoming visible. In its eyes, the gateways had left a residue, three patches of glowing mist. It could not tell one flow from another, but it could distinguish Saidin from Saidar by the smell. Saidin smelled like the sharp edge of a knife, the point of a thorn. Saidar smelled soft, but like something that would grow harder the harder it was pressed. No other Murdral could smell that difference. Shaidar Haran was like no other Murdral. Picking up a discarded spear, Shaidar Haran used it to upend the bag Samael had discarded, and then to stir the bits of stone that fell out. Much was happening outside the plan. Would these events churn chaos, or... Angry black flames raced down the spear haft from Shaidar Haran's hand, the hand of the shadow. In an instant, the wooden haft was charred and twisted, the spearhead dropped off. The Murdral let the blackened stick fall and dusted soot from its palm. If Samael served chaos, then all was well. If not... A sudden ache climbed the back of its neck. A faint weakness washed along its limbs. too long away from Shale Ghul. That tie had to be severed somehow. With a snarl, it turned to find the edge of shadow that it needed. The day was coming. It would come. Chapter 41. The Last Chapter. A Crown of Swords. Tossing, Rand dreamed. Wild dreams, where he argued with Perrin and begged Matt to find Elaine. Where colors flashed just beyond sight, and Padan Fane leaped at him with a flashing blade. And sometimes he thought he heard a voice moaning for a dead woman in the heart of a fog. Dreams where he tried to explain himself to Elaine, to Avienda, to Min, to all three at once. And even Min looked at him with scorn.
"Not to be disturbed,"
Cadswain's voice. Part of his dreams? The voice frightened him. In his dream he shouted for Luz Theron, and the sound echoed through a thick mist where shapes moved and people and horses died screaming. A fog where Cadswain followed him implacably, while he ran, panting. Alana tried to soothe him, but she was afraid of Cadswain, too. He could feel her fear as strongly as his own. His head hurt, and his side. The old scar was fire. He felt Sidene. Someone held Sidene. Was it him? He did not know. He struggled to wake.
"You'll kill him!" Min shouted. "I won't let you kill him!"
His eyes opened, staring up at her face. Not looking at him, she had his head wrapped in her arms and was glaring at someone away from the bed. Her eyes were red. She had been crying, but no longer. Yes, he was in his own bed, in his rooms in the Sun Palace. He could see a heavy square blackwood bedpost set with wedges of ivory. Coatless, in a cream silk blouse, Min lay curled around him protectively, atop the linen sheet that covered him to the neck. Alana was afraid, that lay shivering in the back of his head. Afraid for him. For some reason he was sure of that.
"I think he is awake, Min,"
Amis said gently. Min looked down, and her face, framed in dark ringlets, beamed with a sudden smile. Carefully, because he felt weak, he removed her arms and sat up. His head whirled dizzily, but he forced himself not to lie back again. His bed was ringed. To one side stood Amis, flanked by Bera and Karuna. Amis's two youthful features bore no expression at all, but she brushed back her long white hair and shifted a dark shawl as though tidying herself after a struggle. Outwardly, the two Aes Sedai were serene, yet with determined serenity. A queen ready to fight for her throne, a countrywoman ready to fight for her farm. Oddly, if he had ever seen three people stand together, and not just physically, it was those three, shoulder to shoulder as one. On the opposite side of the bed, Samitsu, with those silver bells in her hair, and a slender sister with thick black eyebrows and a wild look to her raven hair, stood with Cadswain, who had her fists planted on her hips. Samitsu and the raven-haired Aes Sedai wore yellow-fringed shawls and had jaws set every bit as firmly as Bera or Karuna. Yet Cadswain's stern stare made all four appear hesitant. The two groups of women were not staring at one another, but at the men. At the foot of the bed were Dashiva, with the silver sword and red and gold dragon glittering his collar, and Flynn and Narishma, all grim-faced, trying to watch the women on both sides of the bed at once. Jonan Adley stood beside them, his black coat looking singed on one sleeve. Sidene filled all four men, to overflowing, it seemed. Dashiva held almost as much as Rand could have. Rand looked to Adley, who nodded slightly. Abruptly, Rand realized that he was not wearing anything beneath the sheet that had fallen to his waist, and nothing above except a bandage wound around his middle.
"How long have I been asleep?" he asked. "How is it I'm alive?"
He touched the pale bandage gingerly.
"Fane's dagger came from Shadar Logoth. Once I saw it kill a man in moments with a scratch. He died fast, and he died hard."
Dashiva muttered a curse with Padan Fane's name in it. Samitsu and the other yellow exchanged startled looks, but Cadswain merely nodded, the golden ornaments around her iron-gray bun swaying.
"Yes, Shadar Logoth. That would explain several matters. You can thank Sumeko that you're alive,
and Master Flynn?"
She did not glance toward the grizzled man with his fringe of white hair, but he grinned as though she had given him a bow. In truth, surprisingly, the yellows did nod to him.
"And Corella here, of course," Cadswain went on. "Each has done a part, including some things I think have not been done since the breaking."
Her voice turned grim.
"Without all three, you would be dead by now.
You still may die unless you let yourself be guided.
You must rest without exertion."
His stomach rumbled suddenly, loudly, and she added,
"We've only been able to get a little water and broth down you since you were hurt. 2 days is a long time without food for a sick man."
2 days. Only two. He avoided looking at Adley. "I'm getting up," he said.
"I won't let them kill you, sheepherder,"
Min said with an obstinate glint in her eyes.
"And I won't let you kill you either."
She put her arms around his shoulders as if to hold him where he was.
"If the Karakhan wishes to rise," Amis said flatly, "I will have Nandera bring in the maidens from the corridor. Somera and Anila will be especially happy to give him just the assistance he needs."
The corners of her mouth twitched toward a smile. Once a maiden herself, she knew close enough to everything of that situation. Neither Karuna nor Bera smiled. They frowned at him, as at an obstinate fool.
"Boy," Cadswain said dryly, "I've already seen more of your hairless bottom cheeks than I wish to. But if you want to flaunt them in front of all six of us, perhaps someone will enjoy the show. If you fall on your face, though, I may just spank you before I put you back to bed."
By Samitsu's face and Corella's, they would be happy to assist her. Narishma and Adley stared at Cadswain in shock, while Flynn tugged at his coat as though arguing with himself. Dashiva, though, barked a rough laugh.
"If you want us to clear the women out..."
The plain-faced man began preparing flows. Not shields, but complex weaves of spirit and fire that Rand suspected would put anyone they were laid on in too much pain to think of channeling.
"No,"
he said quickly. Bera and Karuna would obey a simple order to go, and if Corella and Samitsu had helped keep him alive, he owed them more than pain. But if Cadswain thought nakedness would hold him where he was, she was in for a surprise. He was not sure the maidens had left him any modesty at all. With a smile from Min, he unwound her arms, tossed back the sheet, and climbed out of the bed on Amisa's side. The Wise One's mouth tightened. He could almost see her considering whether to call for the maidens. Bera gave Amis an agonized, uncertain look, while Karuna hurriedly turned her back, her cheeks darkening. Slowly he walked to the wardrobe. Slowly because he expected he might give Cadswain her chance if he tried to move quickly.
"Fah!" she muttered behind him. "I vow I should smack the stubborn boy's bottom."
Someone grunted what might have been agreement, or just disapproval of what he was doing.
"Ah, but it's such a pretty bottom now, isn't it, that?"
someone else said in a lilting Mirandian accent. That must have been Corella. A good thing he had his head inside the wardrobe. Maybe the maidens had not peeled away as much modesty as he thought.
Light.
His face felt hot as a furnace. Hoping the motions of dressing would cover any wobbles, he climbed into his clothes hurriedly. His sword stood propped in the back of the wardrobe, sword belt wound around the dark boarhide scabbard. He touched the long hilt, then took his hand away. Barefoot, he turned back to the others, while still tying the laces of his shirt. Min still sat cross-legged on the bed in her snug green silk breeches, by her expression, unable to decide between approval and frustration.
"I need to talk with Dashiva and the other Ashaman," he said. "Alone."
Min scrambled off the bed and ran to hug him. Not tightly. She was very careful of his bandaged side.
"I've waited too long to see you awake again," she said, sliding an arm around his waist. "I need to be with you."
She emphasized that just a tad. She must have had a viewing. Or maybe she just wanted to help steady his legs. That arm seemed to offer support. Either way, he nodded. He was not all that steady. Laying a hand on her shoulder, he suddenly realized that he did not want the Ashaman to know how weak he was, any more than Cadswain or Amis. Bera and Karuna made reluctant curtsies and started for the door, then hesitated when Amis did not move right away.
"So long as you do not intend to leave these rooms," the wise one said, not in the slightest as though speaking to her Karakarn.
Rand raised a naked foot.
"Do I look as though I'm going anywhere?"
Amis sniffed, but with a glance at Adley, she gathered up Bera and Karuna and departed. Cadswain and the other two were only a moment more in going. The gray-haired Green glanced at Adley, too. It could not be much of a secret that he had been gone from Carrion for days. At the door, she paused.
"Don't do anything foolish, boy."
She sounded like a stern aunt, cautioning a shiftless nephew without much expectation he would listen. Sumitsu and Karela followed her out, dividing their frowns between him and the Ashaman. As they vanished, Dashiva laughed, a sharp wheeze, shaking his head. He actually sounded amused. Rand stepped away from Min to fetch his boots from beside the wardrobe and take a rolled pair of stockings from inside.
"I'll join you in the anteroom as soon as I'm booted, Dashiva."
The plain-faced Ashaman gave a start. He had been frowning at Adley.
"As you command, my lord dragon," he said, pressing fist to heart.
Waiting until the four men were gone, Rand sat down in a chair with a feeling of relief and began pulling on his stockings. He was sure his legs felt stronger just for being up and moving. Stronger, but they still did not want to support him very well.
"Are you sure this is wise?"
Min said, kneeling beside his chair, and he gave her a startled look. If he had talked in his sleep during those 2 days, the Aes Sedai would have known. Amis would have had Anila and Somera and 50 more maidens waiting when he woke. He tugged the stocking the rest of the way up.
"Do you have a viewing?"
Min sat back on her heels, folded her arms beneath her breasts, and gave him a firm look. After a moment, she decided it was not working and sighed.
"It's Cadswain. She's going to teach you something. You and the Ashaman. All the Ashaman, I mean. It's something you have to learn, but I don't know what it is, except that none of you will like learning it from her. You aren't going to like it at all."
Rand paused with a boot in hand, then stuffed his foot in. What could Cadswain or any Aes Sedai teach the Ashaman? Women could not teach men or men women. That was as hard a fact as the One Power itself.
"We will see," was all he said.
Plainly, that did not satisfy Min. She knew it would happen, and so did he. She was never wrong. But what could Cadswain possibly teach him? What would he let her teach him? The woman made him unsure of himself, uneasy in a way he had not felt since before the Stone of Tear fell. Stamping his foot to settle it in the second boot, he fetched his sword belt from the wardrobe and a red coat worked in gold, the same he had worn to the sea folk.
"What bargain did Mirana make for me?"
he asked, and she made an exasperated sound in her throat.
"None, as of this morning," she said impatiently. "She and Rafella haven't left the ship since we did, but they've sent half a dozen messages asking if you're well enough to return. I don't think the bargaining has gone well for them without you. I suppose it's too much to hope that's where you're going."
"Not yet," he told her.
Min said nothing, but she said it very loudly, fists on her hips and one eyebrow raised high. Well, she would know most of it soon enough. In the anteroom, all the Ashaman except Dashiva sprang out of their chairs when Rand appeared with Min. Staring at nothing and talking to himself, Dashiva did not notice until Rand reached the rising sun set in the floor, and then he blinked several times before rising. Rand addressed himself to Adley while fastening the dragon-shaped buckle of his sword belt.
"The army's reached the hill forts in Ilion already?"
He wanted to take one of the gilded armchairs, but would not let himself.
"How? It should have been several more days at the best. At best!"
Flynn and Narishma looked as startled as Dashiva. None of them had known where Adley and Hopwell had gone, or more. Deciding who to trust was always the difficulty, and trust a razor's edge. Adley drew himself up. There was something about his eyes, beneath those thick eyebrows. He had seen the wolf, as they said in Kyrian.
"The High Lord Wyroman left the foot behind and pressed forward with the horse," he said, reporting stiffly. "The Aiel kept up, of course."
He frowned.
We encountered Aiel yesterday. Shido. I don't know how they got there. There were maybe 9 or 10,000 altogether, but they didn't seem to have any wise ones who could channel with them. And they didn't really slow us down. We reached the hill forts at noon today. Rand wanted to snarl. Leaving the foot behind? Did Wireman think he was going to take palisaded forts on hilltops with horsemen? Probably. The man probably would have left the Aiel behind, too, if he could have outrun them. Fool nobles and their fool honor. Still, it did not matter. Except to the men who died because the High Lord Wireman was contemptuous of anyone who did not fight from horseback. Eben and I began destroying the first palisades soon as we arrived, Abby went on. Wireman didn't much like that. I think he would have stopped us, but he was afraid to. Anyway, we began setting fire to the logs and blowing holes in the walls, but before we more than started, Samael came. A man channeling Saidin, at least, and a lot stronger than Eben or me. As strong as you, my Lord Dragon, I'd say.
He was there right away, Rand said incredulously, but then he understood.
He had been sure Samael would stay safe in Ilion, behind defenses woven of the power, if he thought he had to face Rand. Too many of the Forsaken had tried, and most were dead now. In spite of himself, Rand laughed, and had to hug his side, laughing hurt. All that elaborate deception to convince Samael he would be anywhere but with the invading army, to bring the man out of Ilion, and all made unnecessary by a knife in Padan Fane's hand. 2 days. By this time, everybody who had eyes and ears in Kyrian, which certainly included the Forsaken, knew that the Dragon Reborn lay on the edge of death. As well toss wet wood on the fire as think otherwise. Men scheme and women plot, but the wheel weaves as it will. That was how they said it in Tyr.
Go on, he said.
Mor was with you last night?
Yes, my Lord Dragon. Fedwin comes every night, just like he's supposed to. Last night it was plain as Eben's nose we'd reached the forts today. I don't understand any of this.
Dashiva sounded upset. A muscle in his cheek was twitching.
You've lured him out, but to what purpose? As soon as he feels a man channel with anything near your strength, he'll flee back to Ilion, and whatever traps and alarms he has woven. You won't get at him there. He will know as soon as a gateway opens within a mile of the city.
We can save the army, Adley burst out. That's what we can do.
Wireman was still sending charges against that fort when I left, and Samael cuts everyone to rags despite anything Eben or I can do.
He shifted the arm with the singed sleeve.
We have to strike back and run immediately, and even so, he nearly burned us where we stood more than once. The Aiel are taking casualties, too. They're only fighting the Ilioners who come out. The other hill forts must be emptying, so many were coming when I left. But any time Samael sees 50 of us together, Aiel or anybody, he rips them apart. If there were 3 of him, or even 2, I'm not sure I'd find anybody alive when I go back.
Dashiva stared at him, as if at a madman, and Adley shrugged suddenly, as though feeling the lightness of his bare black collar compared with the sword and dragon on the older man's.
Forgive me, Ashaman, he muttered,
abashed, then added in a still lower voice,
but we can at least save them.
We will,
Rand assured him, just not the way Adley expected.
You're all going to help me kill Samael today.
Only Dashiva looked startled. The other men just nodded. Not even the Forsaken frightened them anymore. Rand expected argument out of Min, maybe a demand to come along, but she surprised him.
I expect you would as soon as no one found out you're gone before they have to, sheepherder.
He nodded, and she sighed. Perhaps the Forsaken had to depend on pigeons and eyes and ears, just like anyone else, but being too sure could be fatal. The maidens will want to come if they know Min. They would want to, and he would be hard-pressed to refuse, if he could refuse. Yet the disappearance even of Nandera and whoever she had on guard might be too much. Min sighed again.
I suppose I could go talk to Nandera. I might be able to keep them out in the hallway for an hour. But they won't be pleased with me when they find out.
He almost laughed again before he remembered his side. They definitely would not be pleased with her, or with him.
More to the point, farm boy, Amis won't be pleased. Or Soralia. The things I let you get me into.
He opened his mouth to tell her he had not asked her to do anything, yet before he could utter a word, she moved very close. Looking up at him, through long lashes, she put a hand on his chest, tapping her fingers. She smiled warmly and kept her voice soft, but the fingers were a giveaway.
If you let anything happen to you, Randall Thor, I'll give Cadswain a hand whether she needs one or not.
Her smile brightened for a moment, almost cheerily, before she turned for the doors. He watched her go. She might make his head spin sometimes. Nearly every woman he had ever met had done that at least a time or two. But she did have a way of walking that made him want to watch. Abruptly he realized Ashiva was watching as well, and licking his lips. Rand cleared his throat loudly enough to be heard over the sound of the door closing behind her. For some reason, the plain-faced man raised his hands defensively. It was not as though Rand glared at him. He could not go around glaring at men just because Min wore tight breeches. Surrounding himself with the emptiness of the void, he seized Sidene and forced frozen fire and molten filth into the weaves for a gateway. Dashiva leaped back as it opened. Maybe having a hand sliced off would teach the man not to lick his lips like a goat. Something crooked and red spiderwebbed across the outside of the void. He stepped through onto bare dirt with Dashiva and the others right behind, releasing the source as soon as the last stepped clear. A sense of loss rushed in as Sayadin left, as awareness of Alana dwindled. The loss had not seemed so great while Luz Theron was there, not so huge. Overhead, the golden sun was more than halfway down to the horizon. A gust of wind swept dust from under his boots without leaving any coolness behind. The gateway had opened in a cleared area, marked off by a rope strung between four wooden posts. At each corner stood a pair of guards in short coats and baggy trousers stuffed into their boots, swords that appeared slightly serpentine, hanging at their sides. Some had heavy mustaches that hung to their chins or thick beards, and all had bold noses and dark eyes that seemed tilted. As soon as Rand appeared, one of them went running. "What are we doing here?" Dashiva said, looking about incredulously. Around them stretched hundreds of sharp-peaked tents, gray and dusty white, tents and picket lines of already saddled horses. Camelin lay not many miles away, hidden behind the trees, and the Black Tower not much farther, but Taim would not know of this unless he had a spy watching. One of Fedwin Moore's tasks had been to listen, to feel for anyone trying to spy. In a ripple of murmurs spreading outward from the ropes, men with bold noses and serpentine swords rose from their heels and turned to stare expectantly toward Rand. Here and there women stood as well. Saldaean women often rode to the wars with their husbands, at least among the nobles and officers. There would be none of that today, though. Ducking under the rope, Rand strode directly to a tent no different from any other, except for the banner on the staff in front, three simple red blossoms on a field of blue. The king's penny did not die back, even in Saldaean winters, and when fires blackened the forests, those red flowers were always the first to reappear. A blossom nothing could kill, the sign of House Bashir. Inside the tent, Bashir himself was already booted and spurred, and his sword on his hip. Ominously, Dira was with him, in a riding dress the same shade as her husband's gray coat, and if she wore no sword, the long dagger at her belt of heavy silver rondelles would do to go on with. The leather gauntlets tucked behind that belt spoke of someone meaning to ride hard. "I hadn't expected this for days yet," Bashir said, rising from a folding camp chair. "Weeks, I hoped, in truth. I'd hoped to have most of Taim's leavings armed the way young Matt and I planned. I've gathered every maker of crossbows I could find into a manufactory, and they're starting to produce them like a sow dropping piglets, but as it is, no more than 15,000 have crossbows and know what to do with them." With a questioning look, he lifted a silver pitcher from atop the maps spread out on his folding table. "Do we have time for punch?" "No punch," Rand said impatiently. Bashir had spoken before about the men Taim found who could not learn to channel, but he had scarcely listened. If Bashir thought he had trained them well enough, that was all that mattered. "Dashiva and three more Ashaman are waiting outside. As soon as Moore joins them, we'll be ready." He eyed Dira Nigalin to Bashir, towering over her diminutive husband with her hawk's beak of a nose and her eyes that made a hawk's look mild.
No punch, Lord Bashir. And no wives. Not today.
Dira opened her mouth, her dark eyes all but glowing suddenly.
No wives, Bashir said, knuckling his heavy gray-streaked mustaches. I will pass the order.
Turning to Dira, he held out his hand.
Wife, he said mildly.
Rand winced, mild tone or no, and waited for the eruption. Dira's mouth thinned. She scowled down at her husband, a hawk ready to stoop on a mouse. Not that Bashir looked anything like a mouse, of course. Just a much smaller hawk. She drew a deep breath. Dira could make drawing a deep breath seem a thing that should cause the earth to tremble. And unhooking her sheathed dagger from her belt, she laid it in her husband's hand.
"We will talk of this later, Davram," she said. "At length."
One day when he had time, Rand decided, he was going to make Bashir explain how he did that. If there ever was time.
"At length," Bashir agreed, grinning through his mustaches as he stuffed the dagger behind his own belt.
Maybe the man was simply suicidal. The rope had been taken down outside, and Rand stood waiting with Dashiva and the other Ashaman, while 9,000 Saldaean light horse arrayed themselves behind Bashir in a column of threes. Somewhere behind them, 15,000 men who called themselves the Legion of the Dragon would be gathering afoot. Rand had glimpsed them, everyone in a blue coat made to button up the side so the red and gold dragon across the chest would not be broken. Most carried steel-armed crossbows. Some bore heavy, unwieldy shields instead, but not one carried a pike. Whatever odd notion Madame Bashir had cooked up, Rand hoped it would not lead a lot of this legion to death. Moore grinned eagerly while he waited, all but bouncing on his toes. Perhaps he was simply glad to be back in his black coat with the silver sword on his collar, yet Adli and Narishma wore almost identical grins, and for that matter, Flynn's was not far off. They knew where they were going now, and what to do there. Dashiva was scowling at nothing, as usual, his lips moving silently, as usual. Also silent, scowling, were the Saldaean women, gathered behind Dira, watching from one side. Eagles and falcons, feathers ruffled and furious. Rand did not care how they grimaced and frowned. If he could face Nandera and the rest of the maidens after keeping them back from this, then the Saldaean men could put up with any number of lengthy discussions. Today, the light-willing, no women would die because of him. So many men could not be lined up in a minute, even when they had been awaiting the order. But in a remarkably short time, Bashir raised his sword and called,
"My Lord Dragon!"
A shout rippled down the great column behind him.
"The Lord Dragon!"
Seizing the source, Rand made a gateway between the posts, 4 paces by 4, and ran through as he tied off the weave, filled with Sayadin, and the Ashaman on his heels, into a great open square surrounded by huge white columns, each topped with a marble wreath of olive branches. At the two ends of the square stood nearly identical purple-roofed palaces of columned walks and high balconies and slender spires. Those were the King's Palace and the slightly smaller Great Hall of the Council. This was the square of Tammuz, in the heart of Ilion. A skinny man in a blue coat, with a beard that left his upper lip bare, stood gaping at the sight of Rand and the black-coated Ashaman leaping out of a hole in midair, and a stout woman, in a green dress cut high enough to show green slippers and her ankles in green stockings, pressed both hands to her face and stood rooted right in front of them, her dark eyes popping. All the people were stopping to stare, hawkers with their trays, carters halting their oxen, men and women and children with their mouths hanging open. Rand thrust his hands high and channeled.
"I am the dragon reborn."
The words boomed across the square, amplified by air and fire, and flames shot up from his hands 100 feet. Behind him, the Ashaman filled the sky with balls of fire streaking in every direction. All save Dashiva, who made blue lightnings crackle in a jagged web above the square. No more was needed. A shrieking flood of humanity fled in all directions, away from the square of Tammuz. They fled just in time. Rand and the Ashaman darted aside from the gateway, and Davram Bashir led his wildly screaming Saldaeans into Ilion, a flood of horsemen waving their swords as they poured out. Straight ahead, Bashir led the center line of the column, just as they had planned what seemed so long ago, while the other two lines peeled off to either side. They streamed away from the gateway, breaking apart into smaller groups, galloping into the streets leading out of the square. Rand did not wait to see the last of the horsemen exit. With well under a third out of the gateway, he immediately wove another, smaller opening. You did not need to know a place at all to travel if you only intended to go a very short distance. Around him he felt Dashiva and the rest weaving their gateways. But he was already stepping through his own, letting it close behind him atop one of the slender towers of the king's palace. Absently, he wondered whether Matin Stepaneos Din Bolgar, the king of Ilion, was somewhere below him at that moment. The top of the spire stretched no more than 5 paces across, surrounded by a wall of redstone not quite chest high on him. At 50 paces, it was the highest point in all of the city. From there, he could see across rooftops glittering beneath the afternoon sun, red and green and every color, to the long earthen causeways that cut through the vast, tall grass marsh surrounding city and harbor. A sharp tang of salt hung in the air. Ilion had no need of walls, with that all-enveloping marsh to stop an attacker. Any attacker who could not make holes in the air. But then, walls would have done no good either. It was a pretty city, the buildings mainly of pale-dressed stone, a city crisscrossed by as many canals as streets, like traceries of blue-green from this height. But he did not stop to admire it. Low across the roofs of taverns and shops and spired palaces, he directed flows of air and water, fire and earth and spirit, turning as he did so. He did not try to weave the flows, simply swept them out over the city and a good mile out over the marsh. From 5 other towers came flows sweeping low, and where they touched one another uncontrolled, light flashed and sparks flared and clouds of colored steam burst, a display any illuminator might have envied. A better way to frighten people under their beds and out of the way of Bashir's soldiers he could not imagine, though that was not the reason for it. Long ago he had decided that Samael must have wards woven throughout the city, set to give an alarm should anyone channel Sayadin. Wards inverted so no one except Samael himself could find them. Wards that would tell Samael exactly where that man was channeling, so he could be destroyed on the instant. With luck, every one of those wards was being triggered now. Luce Theron had been sure Samael would sense them wherever he was, even at a distance. That was why the wardings should be useless now. That sort had to be remade once triggered. Samael would come. Never in his life had he relinquished anything he considered his, however shaky his claim, not without a fight. All that from Luce Theron. If he was real. He had to be. Those memories had too much detail. But could not a madman dream his fancies in detail, too? Luce Theron, he called silently. The wind blowing across Ilion answered. Below, the square of Tammuz stood deserted and silent, empty except for a few abandoned carts. Edge on, the gateway was invisible, except for the weaves. Reaching down to those weaves, Rand untied the knot and, as the gateway winked from existence, reluctantly released Sayadin. All the flows vanished from the sky. Maybe some of the Ashaman still held on to the source, but he had told them not to. He had told them that any man he felt channeling in Ilion once he himself stopped, he intended to kill without warning. He did not want to find out afterward that the channeler had been one of them. He leaned on the wall, waiting, wishing he could sit. His legs ached and his side burned however he stood, yet he might need to see as well as feel a weave. The city was not entirely quiet. From several directions he could hear distant shouts, the faint clash of metal. Even moving so many men to the border, Samael had not left Ilion entirely unprotected. Rand turned, trying to watch in every direction. He thought Samael would come to the king's palace, or that other at the far end of the square, but he could not be certain. Down one street he saw a band of Saldaeans clashing with an equal number of mounted men in shining breastplates. More Saldaeans suddenly galloped in from one side, and the fight vanished from his sight behind buildings. In another direction he spotted some of the Legion of the Dragon, marching across a canal's low bridge. An officer marked by a tall red plume on his helmet strode ahead of some 20 men carrying wide shields as tall as their shoulders, followed by perhaps 200 more with heavy crossbows. How would they fight? Shouts, and steel ringing on steel in the distance, the faint screams of dying men. The sun slid downward, and shadows lengthened across the city. Twilight, and the sun a low crimson dome in the west. A few stars appeared. Had he been wrong? Would Samael simply go elsewhere, find another land to master? Had he been listening to anything other than his own mad ramblings? A man channeled. For a moment, Rand froze, staring at the great hall of the council. That had been enough of Sidene for a gateway. He might not have felt a much smaller channeling the length of the square. It had to be Samael. In an instant, he had seized the source, woven a gateway, and leaped through with lightning ready to fly from his hands. It was a large room, lit by huge mirrored, golden stand lamps, and others hanging on chains from the ceiling, with snowy white marble walls carved in friezes showing battles, and ships crowding the marsh-bordered harbor of Ilion itself. At the far end of the room, 9 heavily carved and gilded armchairs stood like thrones atop a high, stair-fronted white dais, the center chair with a back higher than any other. Before he could release the gateway behind him, the tower top where he had stood exploded. He felt the wash of fire and earth even as a storm of stone fragments and dust struck through the gateway, knocking him down on his face. Pain stabbed his side as he landed, a sharp red lance digging into the void where he floated, and that as much as anything else made him release the gateway. Someone else's pain, someone else's weakness. He could ignore them in the void. He moved, forcing another man's muscles to work, pushed himself up and scrambled away in a lurching run toward the dais, just as hundreds of red filaments burned down through the ceiling, burned through the sea-blue marble floor in a wide circle all around where the residue of his gateway was still fading. One stab through the heel of his boot, through his heel, and he heard himself cry out as he fell. Not his pain, inside or foot. Not his. Rolling onto his back, he could see the remnants of those burning red wires still, fresh enough to make out fire and air, woven in a way he had not known. Enough to make out exactly the direction they had come from. Black holes in the floor, and ornately worked white plaster ceiling high overhead, hissed and crackled loudly at the touch of the air. His hands rose, and he wove balefire. Began to weave it. Someone else's cheek stung from a remembered slap, and Cadswain's voice hissed and crackled in his head, like the holes the red filaments had made. "Never again, boy. You will never do that again." It seemed that he heard Luce Theron whimpering in distant fear of what he was about to loose, what had almost destroyed the world once. Every flow but fire and air fell away, and he wove as he had seen. 1,000 fine hairs of red blossomed between his hands. Fanning out slightly, they shot upward. A circle of the ceiling, 2 feet across, fell in stone chips and plaster dust. Only after he had done it did he think that there might be someone between him and Samael. He intended to see Samael dead this day, but if he could do it without killing anyone else... The weaves vanished as he pulled himself to his feet once more, and limped hurriedly to the doors in the side of the hall, tall things with every panel set with 9 golden bees the size of his fist. A small flow of air pushed one door open before he reached it, too small to be detected at any distance. Hobbling into the corridor, he sank to one knee. The other man's side was fire, his heel agony. Rand pulled his sword up and leaned on it, waiting. A clean-shaven fellow with plump pink cheeks peered around a corner down the way. Enough of his coat showed to name him a servant. At least, a coat green on one side and yellow on the other looked like livery. The fellow saw Rand, and, very slowly, as though he might not be noticed if he moved slowly enough, slid back out of sight. Sooner or later, Samael would have to.
"Ilion belongs to me!"
The voice boomed in the air from every direction, and Rand cursed. It had to be the same weave he himself had used in the square, or something very like. It required so little of the power, he might not have felt the actual flows had he been within 10 paces of the man.
"Ilion is mine! I won't destroy what belongs to me killing you. And I won't let you destroy it either. You had the nerve to come after me here? Do you have the courage to follow me again?"
A sly mocking tone entering that thundering voice.
"Do you have the courage?"
Somewhere above, a gateway opened and closed. Rand had no doubt that was what it was. The courage? Did he have the courage? "I'm the Dragon Reborn," he muttered, "and I'm going to kill you." Weaving a gateway, he stepped through to a place floors above. It was another hallway, lined with wall hangings, showing ships at sea. At the far end, the last crimson sliver of the sun shone through a colonnaded walk. The residue of Samael's gateway hung in the air, the dissipating flows like faintly glowing ghosts. Not so faint, Rand could not make them out, though. He began to weave, then stopped. He had leaped up here without a thought of a trap. If he copied what he saw exactly, he would step out wherever Samael had, or so close as made no difference. But with just a slight alteration, no way to be sure whether the change was 50 feet or 500, yet either was close enough. The vertical silver slash began to rotate open, revealing the shadow-cloaked ruins of greatness, not quite as dark as the hallway. Seen through the gateway, the sun was a slightly thicker slice of red, half hidden by a shattered dome. He knew that place. The last time he had gone there, he had added a name to that list of maidens in his head. The first time, Padan Thane had followed and become more than a dark friend, worse than a dark friend. That Samael had fled to Shadar Logoth seemed like coming full circle in more ways than one. There was no time to waste now that he was opening the way. Before the gateway stopped widening, he ran through into the ravaged city that once had been called Aradhol, ran limping, letting the weave go as he ran, boots crunching on broken paving stones and dead weeds. The first corner he came to, he ducked around. The ground shook under his feet as roars sounded back the way he had come, light flashing atop flash in the twilight darkness. He felt the wash of earth and fire and air. Shrieks and bellows rose through the thunderous crashes. Saidin pulsing inside him, he hobbled away without looking back. He ran, and with the power filling him, even in the dark shadows he could see clearly. All around the great city lay huge marble palaces, each with 4 and 5 domes of different shapes painted crimson by the setting sun, bronze fountains and statues at every intersection, great stretches of columns running to towers that soared across the sun. They soared when intact, at least. More ended in abrupt jaggedness than not. For every dome that stood whole, 10 were broken eggshells, with the top hacked off, or one side gone. Statues lay toppled in fragments or stood with missing arms or heads. Swiftly deepening darkness raced across sprawling hills of rubble, the few stunted trees clinging to their slopes twisted shapes like broken fingers against the sky. A fan of bricks and stone spread across the way from what might have been a small palace. Half its front missing, the rest of the columned facade leaned drunkenly toward the street. He stopped in the middle of the street, just short of the fan, waiting, feeling for another to use Saidin. Clinging to the sides of the street was not a good idea, and not simply because any building might fall at any time. 1,000 unseen eyes seemed to watch from windows like gouged eye sockets, to watch with a nearly palpable sense of anticipation. Distantly he felt the new wound in his side throbbing, a slash of flame, echoing the evil that clung to the very dust of Shadar Logoth. The old scar clenched like a fist. The pain of his foot seemed very distant indeed. The pain of his foot seemed very distant indeed. Closer, the void itself pulsated around him, the Dark One's taint and Saidin beating in time with a knife slash across his ribs. A dangerous place by daylight, Shadar Logoth. By night. Down the street, beyond a spired monument, miraculously standing straight, something moved. A shadowed shape darting across the way in the darkness. Rand almost channeled, but he could not believe Samael would go scudding that way. When he first stepped into the city, when Samael tried to destroy everything around his gateway, he had heard horrible screams. They had barely registered then. Nothing lived in Shadar Logoth, not even rats. Samael must have brought henchmen, fellows he did not mind killing in an attempt to reach Rand. Maybe one of them could lead Rand to Samael. He hurried forward as fast as he could, as soundlessly as he could. Shattered pavement crunched under his boots with a sound like bones snapping. He hoped it was loud only to his Saidin-enhanced ears. Stopping at the base of the spire, a thick stone needle covered with flowing script, he peered ahead. Whoever had moved was gone. Only fools or the madly brave went inside Shadar Logoth at night. The evil that stained Shadar Logoth, the evil that had murdered Aradhol, had not died with Aradhol. Farther along the street, a tendril of silver-gray fog wavered out of a window, creeping toward another that came to meet it from a wide gap in a high stone wall. The depth of that gap shone, as though a full moon lay inside. With the night, Mashadar roamed its city prison, a vast presence that could appear in a dozen places at once, 100.
Mashadar's touch was not a pleasant way to die. Inside Rand, the taint on Sidene beat harder. The distant fire in his side flickered like 10,000 lightnings, one on top of the last. Even the ground seemed to pound beneath his boots. He turned, half thinking to leave now. Very likely Samael had gone, now that Mashadar was out. Very likely the man had lured him here in the hope he would search the ruins until Mashadar killed him. He turned and stopped, crouching against the spire. Two Trollocs were creeping down that street, bulky shapes in black mail, half again as tall as he, or more. Spikes stood out on the shoulders and elbows of their armor, and they carried spears with long black points and wicked hooks. To his Sidene-filled eyes, their faces stood out clearly, one distorted by an eagle's beak where mouth and nose should have been, the other by a boar's tusked snout. Every line of their creeping shouted fear. Trollocs loved killing, loved blood, but Shadar Logoth terrified them. There would be Murdral about. No Trolloc would have entered this city without Murdral to drive it. No Murdral would have entered without Samael driving. All of which meant Samael must still be here, or these Trollocs will be running for the gates, not hunting. And they were hunting. That boar's snout was snuffling the air for a scent. Abruptly, a figure in rags leaped from a window above the Trollocs, falling on them with spear already stabbing. An Aiel, a woman, shufa wrapped around her head, but veil hanging. The eagle-beaked Trolloc shrieked as her spear point stabbed deep into its side, stabbed again. As its companion fell, kicking, Borsnout spun with snarl, thrusting viciously, but she ducked low under the black hooked point, and stabbed up into the creature's stomach, and it went down in a thrashing heap with the other. Rand was on his feet and running before he thought.
"Liar!"
he shouted. He had thought her dead, abandoned here by him, dead for him. Liar of the Kosaida Charin. That name blazed on the list in his head. She whirled to confront him, spear ready in one hand, round bullhide buckler in the other. The face he remembered as pretty despite scars on both cheeks was contorted with rage.
"Mine!" she hissed threateningly through her teeth. "Mine! No one may come here! No one!"
He stopped in his tracks. That spear waited, eager to seek his ribs, too.
"Liar, you know me," he said softly. "You know me. I'll take you back to the maidens, back to your spear sisters."
He held out his hand. Her rage melted into a twisted frown. She tilted her head to one side.
"Randall Thor,"
she said slowly. Her eyes widened, falling to the dead Trollocs, and a look of horror spread across her face.
"Randall Thor,"
she whispered, fumbling the black veil into place across her face with the hand that held her spear.
"The Karakarn,"
she wailed, and fled. He hobbled after her, scrambling over piles of rubble spread across the street, falling, ripping his coat, falling again, and nearly ripping it off, rolling and picking himself up on the run. The weakness of his body was distant, and the pain of it, but even floating deep in the void, he could only push that body so hard. Lya vanished into the night. Around the next black-shadowed corner, he thought. He limped around that as fast as he could, and nearly ran into four black-mailed Trollocs and a Murdral, inky cloak hanging unnaturally still down its back as the fade moved. The Trollocs snarled in surprise, yet shock lasted less than a heartbeat. Hooked spears and scythe-curved swords rose. The Murdral's dead black blade was in its fist, a blade that gave wounds almost as deadly as Fane's dagger. Rand did not even try to draw the Heronmark sword at his side. Death in a tattered red coat, he channeled, and a sword of fire was in his hands, pulsing darkly with the throb of Sidene, sweeping an eyeless head from its shoulders. Simpler to have destroyed them all the way he'd seen the Ashaman kill at Dumai's Wells, but changing the weaves now, trying to change, might take a fatal moment. Those swords could kill even him. He danced the forms in a darkness lit by the flame in his hands, shadows flying across faces above him, faces with wolves' muzzles and goats, faces contorted in screams as his fiery blade sliced through black mail and the flesh beneath, as if they were water. Trollocs depended on numbers and overwhelming ferocity. Facing him and that sword of the power, they might as well have stood stock still, unarmed. The sword vanished from his hands. Still poised at the end of the form called Twisting the Wind, he stood among death. The last Trolloc to fall still thrashed, goat horns scraping on the fragmented pavement. The headless Murdral yet flung its arms about, of course, booted feet scrabbling wildly. Halfman did not die quickly, even headless. No sooner did the sword disappear than silver lightning lanced down from the cloudless, starry sky. The first bolt struck with a deafening roar not 4 paces away. The world turned white, and the void collapsed. The ground bounced under him as another bolt struck, and another. He had not realized he was on his face until then. The air crackled. Dazed, he pushed himself up, half falling as he ran from a hail of lightning that ripped the street apart to a thunder of collapsing buildings. Straight ahead he staggered, not caring where, so long as it was away. Suddenly his head cleared enough for him to see where he was, reeling across a vast stone floor covered with tumbled chunks of stone, some as big as he. Here and there, dark, uneven holes gaped in the floor stones. All around rose high walls and tier upon tier of deep balconies that ran all the way around. Only a small portion of what had once been a vast roof remained at one corner. Stars shone bright overhead. He lurched another step, and the floor gave way beneath him. Desperately, he flung out his hands. With a jolt, the right hand caught hold of a rough edge. He dangled into pitch blackness. The fall beneath his boots might be a few spans into a basement, or a mile, for all he could tell. He could latch bands of air to the jagged rim of the hole above his head to help pull himself out, except... Somehow Samael had sensed the relatively small amount of cyodine used in the sword. There had been a delay before the lightning struck, but he could not say how long he had taken killing the Trollocs. A minute? Seconds? With a heave, he swung his left arm up, trying to catch the edge of the hole. Pain no longer buffered by the void stabbed through his side like a dagger going in. Spots danced in his vision. Worse, his right hand slipped on crumbling stone, and he could feel his fingers weakening. He was going to have to. A hand grabbed his right wrist. "You are a fool," a man's deep voice said. "Count yourself lucky I don't care to see you die today." The hand began drawing him up. "Are you going to help?" the voice demanded. "I don't intend to carry you on my shoulders or kill Samael for you." Shaking off his shock, Rand reached up and grabbed the rim of the hole, pulling despite the agony of his side. Despite the agony, he managed to acquire the void again, too, and seize Cyadine. He did not channel, but he wanted to be ready. His head and shoulders came above the floor, and he could see the other man, a big fellow, little older than he, with hair black as the night, and a coat black as an Ashaman's. Rand had never seen him before. At least he was not one of the Forsaken. Those faces he knew. He thought he did, anyway. "Who are you?" he demanded. Still heaving, the man barked a laugh. "Just say I'm a wanderer passing through. Do you really want to talk now?" Saving his breath, Rand struggled upward, getting his chest over the lip, his waist. Abruptly he realized that a glow bathed the floor around them, like the glow of a full moon. Twisting to look over his shoulder, he saw Mashadar. Not a tendril, but a shining silver-gray wave rolling out of one of the balconies, arching over their heads, descending. Without a thought, his free hand rose and balefire shot upward, a bar of liquid white fire slicing across the wave sinking toward them. Dimly he was aware of another bar of pale solid fire rising from the other man's hand that was not clasping his, a bar slashing the opposite way from his. The two touched. Head ringing like a struck gong, Rand convulsed, Cyadine and the void shattering. Everything was doubled in his eyes, the balconies, the chunks of stone lying about the floor. There seemed to be a pair of the other man overlapping one another, each clutching his head between two hands. Blinking, Rand searched for Mashadar. The wave of shining mist was gone. A glow remained in the balconies above, but dimming, receding, as Rand's eyes began to clear. Even mindless Mashadar fled balefire, it seemed. Unsteadily, he got to his feet and offered a hand. "I think we best move quickly. What happened there?" The other man pushed himself up, with a grimace at Rand's proffered hand. He was easily as tall as Rand, rare except among the Aiel. "I don't know what happened," he snarled. "Run if you want to live." He suited his own words immediately, dashing toward a row of open arches. Not in the nearest wall, Mashadar had come from that one.
Fumbling for the void, Rand limped after him as best he could, but before they were completely across the floor, the lightnings fell again, a storm of silver arrows. The two of them darted through the archways, pursued by the thunder of walls and floor collapsing behind them, by clouds of dust and a hail of stones. Shoulders hunched and an arm across his face, Rand ran coughing through a broad room where trembling arches supported the ceiling and bits of stone rained down. He burst out into a street before he knew it, stumbling three steps before stopping. The pain in his side made him want to bend over, but he thought his legs might give way if he did. His wounded foot throbbed. It seemed a year ago that that red wire of fire and air had stabbed his heel. His rescuer stood watching him. Covered with dust head to toe, the fellow managed to look like a king. "Who are you?" Rand asked again. "One of Taim's men? Or did you cheat yourself? You can go to Camelin, you know, to the Black Tower. You don't have to live afraid of Aes Sedai." For some reason, saying that made him frown. He could not understand why.
"I have never been afraid of Aes Sedai," the man snapped, then drew a deep breath. "You probably should leave here now, but if you intend to stay and kill Samael, you had better try thinking like him. You have shown you can. He always liked destroying a man inside of one of that man's triumphs, if he could. Lacking that, somewhere the man had marked as his would do."
"The Waygate," Rand said slowly. If he could be said to have marked anything in Chadar Logoth, it had to be the Waygate.
"He's waiting near the Waygate, and he has traps set.
Wards as well, it seemed, like those in Ilion, to detect a man channeling. Samael had planned this well." The man laughed wryly.
"You can find the way, it seems, if you're led by the hand. Try not to stumble. A great many plans will have to be relayed if you let yourself be killed now."
Turning, he started across the street for an alleyway just ahead of them.
"Wait!"
Rand called. The fellow kept on, not looking back.
"Who are you? What plans?"
The man vanished into the alley. Rand teetered after him, but when he reached the mouth of the narrow alley, it was empty. Unbroken walls ran a good 100 paces to another street, where a glow told of yet another part of Mashadar abroad. But the man was gone, which was purely impossible. The fellow had had time to make a gateway, of course, if he knew how, but the residue would have been visible, and besides, that much of Sidene being woven so near would have shouted at him. Suddenly he realized that he had not felt Sidene when the man made Balefire either. Just thinking of that, of the two streams touching, made his vision double again. Just for an instant he could see the man's face again, sharp where everything else blurred. He shook his head until it cleared.
"Who in the light are you?" he whispered.
And after a moment,
"What in the light are you?"
Whoever or whatever, the man was gone, though. Samael was still in Chadar Logoth. With an effort, he managed to regain the void once more. The taint on Sidene vibrated now, humming its way deep into him. The void itself vibrated. But the weakness of watery muscles and the pain of injuries faded. He was going to kill one of the Forsaken before this night was done. Limping, he ghosted through the dark streets, placing his feet with great care. He still made noise, but the night was full of noise now. Shrieks and guttural cries sounded in the distance. Mindless Mashadar killed whatever it found, and Trollocs were dying in Chadar Logoth tonight as they had once long, long ago. Sometimes down a crossing street he saw Trollocs, 2 or 5 or 12, occasionally with a half-man, but most often not. None saw him, and he did not bother them. Not simply because Samael would detect any channeling. Those Trollocs and Murdral that Mashadar did not kill were still dead. Samael had almost certainly brought them by the ways, but apparently he did not realize just how Rand had marked the Waygate here. Well short of the square where the Waygate lay, Rand stopped and looked around. Nearby, a tower stood seemingly whole. Not nearly as tall as some, its top still rose more than 50 paces above the ground. The dark doorway at its base was empty, the wood long rotted away, and the hinges gone to dust. Through blackness relieved only by faint starlight through the windows, he climbed the winding stairs slowly, small clouds puffing up beneath his boots, every second step a stab of pain up his leg. Distant pain. On the tower top, he leaned against the smooth parapet to catch his breath. The idle thought came that he would never hear the end if Min learned of this.
Min, or Amis, or Cadswain, for that matter. Across missing rooftops, he could see the great square that had been one of the most important in Aradhol. Once an Ogier grove had covered this part of the land, but within 30 years after the Ogier who had built the oldest parts of the city departed, the residents had cut down the trees to make room for expanding Aradhol. Palaces and the remains of palaces surrounded the huge square, the glow of Mashadar shining deep inside a few windows, and a huge mound of rubble covered one end, but in the center stood the waygate, apparently a tall, broad piece of stone. He was not close enough to see the delicately carved leaves and vines that covered it, but he could make out the toppled pieces of high fence that had once surrounded it. Power-wrought metal lying in a heap, they gleamed untarnished in the night. He could also see the trap he had woven around the waygate, inverted so no eye but his could see it. No way to tell by looking whether the Trollocs and Halfmen really had passed through it, yet if they had, they would die before long. A nasty thing. Whatever traps Samael had made down there were invisible to him, but that was expected. Likely they were not very pleasant either. At first he could not see Samael, but then someone moved among the fluted flaring columns of a palace. Rand waited. He wanted to be sure. He had only one chance. The figure stepped forward, out of the columns, and a pace into the square, head swinging this way and that. Samael, with snowy lace shining at his throat, waiting to see Rand walk into the square, into the traps. Behind him, the glow in the windows of the palace brightened. Samael peered into the darkness lying across the square, and Mashadar oozed out of the windows, thick billows of silver-gray fog sliding together, merging as they loomed above his head. Samael walked a little to one side, and the wave began to descend, slowly picking up speed as it fell. Rand shook his head. Samael was his. The flows needed for balefire seemed to gather themselves, despite the far echo of Cadswain's voice. He raised his hand. A scream tore the darkness, a woman shrieking in agony beyond knowing. Rand saw Samael turn to stare toward the great mound of rubble, even as his own eyes flashed that way. Atop the mound, a shape stood outlined against the night sky in coat and breeches, a single thin tendril of Mashadar touching her leg. Arms outstretched, she thrashed about, unable to move from the spot, and her wordless wail seemed to call Rand's name. "Lyra," he whispered. Unconsciously he reached out, as though he could stretch his arm across the intervening distance and pull her away. Nothing could save what Mashadar touched, though. No more than anything could have saved him had Fane's dagger plunged into his heart. "Lyra," he whispered, and balefire leaped from his hand. For less than a heartbeat, the shape of her still seemed to be there, all in stark blacks and snowy whites, and then she was gone, dead before her agony began. Screaming, Rand swept the balefire down toward the square, the rubble collapsing on itself, swept down death out of time, and let Sidene go before the bar of white touched the lake of Mashadar that now rolled across the square, billowing past the waygate toward rivers of glowing gray that flowed out from another palace on the other side. Samael had to be dead. He had to be. There had not been time for him to run, no time to weave a gateway, and if he had, Rand would have felt Sidene being worked. Samael was dead, killed by an evil almost as great as himself. Emotion raced across the outside of the void. Rand wanted to laugh, or perhaps cry. He had come here to kill one of the Forsaken, but instead he had killed a woman he had abandoned here to her fate. For a long time he stood on the tower top while the waning moon crossed the sky, almost at its half. Stood watching Mashadar fill the square completely, till only the very top of the waygate rose above the surface of the fog. Slowly it began to ebb away, hunting elsewhere. If Samael had been alive, he could have killed the Dragon Reborn easily then. Rand was not sure he would have cared. Finally, he opened a gateway for skimming and made a platform, a railless disk, half white and half black. Skimming was slower than traveling. It took him at least half an hour to reach Ilion, and the whole way he burned Lyra's name into his mind again and again, flailing himself with it. He wished he could cry. He thought he had forgotten how. They were waiting for him in the king's palace in the throne room, Bashir and Dashiva and the Asherman. It was exactly like the room he had seen at the other end of the square, down to the stand lamps and the scenes carved into the marble walls and the long white dais. Exactly the same, except for being slightly larger in every dimension, and instead of 9 chairs on the dais, there was only a great gilded throne with leopards for its arms, and 9 fist-sized golden bees that would stand above the head of whoever sat in it. Wearily, Aran sat himself down on the steps at the front of the dais.
"I take it Samael is dead," Bashir said, looking him up and down in his ragged coat and dust.
"He's dead," Rand said. Dashiva sighed loudly with relief.
"The city is ours," Bashir went on. "Or I should say, yours."
He laughed suddenly.
"The fighting stopped quick enough once the right people found out it was you. Not much to it in the end."
Dried blood made a black stain down one torn sleeve of his coat.
"The Council has been waiting eagerly for you to come back. Anxiously, you might say," he added with a wry grin.
8 sweating men had been standing at the far end of the throne room since Rand came in. They wore dark silk coats with gold or silver embroidery on the lapels and sleeves, and falls of lace at their throats and wrists. Some wore a beard that left the upper lip shaved clean, but every one had a broad sash of green silk slanted across his chest, with 9 golden bees marching up it. At Bashir's gesture, they came forward, bowing to Rand at about every third step, for all the world as though he wore the finest garment sewn. A tall man seemed to be the leader, a round-faced fellow with one of those beards, with a natural dignity that appeared strained by worry.
"My lord dragon,"
he said, bowing again and pressing both hands to his heart.
"Forgive me, but Lord Bryn do be nowhere to be found, and—"
"He won't be," Rand said flatly. A muscle in the man's face jumped at Rand's tone, and he swallowed.
"As you do say, my lord dragon,"
he murmured.
"I do be Lord Gregorin den Lucianos, my lord dragon. In Lord Bryn's absence, I do speak for the Council of 9. We do offer you—"
A hand at his side waved vigorously at a shorter, beardless man who stepped forward bearing a cushion draped with a length of green silk.
"We do offer you Ilion."
The shorter man whipped the cloth away, revealing a heavy gold circlet, 2 inches wide, of laurel leaves.
"The city do be yours, of course," Gregorin went on anxiously. "We did put an end to all resistance. We do offer you the crown and the throne and all of Ilion."
Rand stared at the crown on its cushion, not moving a muscle. People had thought he meant to make himself a king in Tyr, feared he would in Carrion and Andor, but no one had offered him a crown before.
"Why? Is Matin Stepanaeus so willing to give up his throne?"
"King Matin did disappear 2 days ago," Gregorin said. "Some of us do fear. We do fear Lord Bryn may have something to do with it. Bryn does have—"
He stopped to swallow.
"Bryn did have a great deal of influence with the king. Some might say too much. But he did be distracted in recent months, and Matin had begun to reassert himself."
Strips of grimy coat sleeve and pieces of shirt sleeve dangled as Rand reached to pick up the laurel crown. The dragon wound around his forearm glittered in the lamplight as brightly as the golden crown. He turned it in his hands.
"You still haven't said why."
"Because I conquered you?"
He had conquered Tyr and Carrion, too, but some turned on him in both lands still. Yet it seemed to be the only way.
"That do be part," Gregorin said dryly. "Even so, we might have chosen one of our own. Kings have come from the Council before. But the grain you did order sent from Tyr has your name on every lip with the light. Without that, many would be dead of starvation. Bryn did see every stick of bread go to the army."
Rand blinked and snatched one hand from the crown to suck on a pricked finger. Almost buried among the laurel leaves of the crown were the sharp points of swords. How long ago had he commanded the Tyrans to sell grain to their ancient enemy, sell it, or die for refusing? He had not realized they kept on after he began preparations to invade Ilion. Maybe they feared to bring it up, but they had feared to stop, too. Maybe he had earned some right to this crown. Gingerly, he set the circle of laurel leaves on his head. Half those swords pointed up, half down. No head would wear this crown casually or easily. Rigorin bowed smoothly.
"The light illumine Randall Thor, King of Ilion," he intoned,
and the seven other lords bowed with him, murmuring, "The light illumine Randall Thor, King of Ilion." Bashir contented himself with a bow of his head. He was uncle to a queen, after all. But Dashiva cried out,
"All hail Randall Thor, King of the World!"
Flynn and the other Ashaman took it up.
"All hail Randall Thor, King of the World! All hail the King of the World!"
That had a good sound to it. The story spread, as stories will, and changed as stories change with time and distance, spreading out from Ilion by coasting ships and merchant trains of wagons, and pigeons sent in secret, spreading in ripples that danced with other ripples and made new. An army had come to Ilion, the story said, an army of Aiel, of Aes Sedai appearing from thin air, of men who could channel riding winged beasts, even an army of Saldaeans, though not many believed that one. Some tales said the dragon reborn had been presented the laurel crown of Ilion by the Council of Nine, and others by Matin Stepanaeus himself on bended knee. A Crown of Swords, by Robert Jordan, Part 2, concluded. Some tales said the dragon reborn had been presented the laurel crown of Ilion by the Council of Nine, and others by Matin Stepanaeus himself on bended knee. Some said the dragon reborn had wrenched the crown from Matin's head, then stuck that head on a spike. No, the dragon reborn had raised Ilion to the ground and buried the old king in the rubble. No, he and his army of Ashaman had burned Ilion out of the earth. No, it was Ebudar he had destroyed, after Ilion. One fact, though, turned up again and again in those tales. The laurel crown of Ilion had been given a new name, the Crown of Swords. And for some reason, men and women who told the tales often found a need to add almost identical words. "The storm is coming," they said, staring southward in worry. "The storm is coming."
Master of the lightnings, rider on the storm, wearer of a crown of swords, spinner out of fate, who thinks he turns the wheel of time, may learn the truth too late. From a fragmentary translation of the Prophecies of the Dragon, attributed to Lord Mangor Kiramin, sword bard of Aramael and warder to Karaigan Makonar, into what was then called the Vulgar Tongue, circa 300 A.B. The end of the seventh book of the Wheel of Time.